Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, liberty-loving patriot. Welcome to the Lucid Libertarian with Lorianne Show. Please be sure to tune in Sunday nights from 6 p.m. to 8 p.m. Pacific Time, 9 to 11 p.m. Eastern, to discuss current events, news, and political opinion with Lucid Libertarian flair. Be prepared, folks. We often go into an optional extended third hour. This show advocates for liberty, freedom, our Constitution, Bill of Rights, and limited government, while speaking against corporate and government corruption, tyranny, and the globalist Great Reset agenda that undermines our precious American sovereignty. Discussions here are unscripted and free-flowing, so sometimes conversations wander off in unpredictable directions. Would you like to call in and share your thoughts and be part of the conversation? The number is 563-999-3698. Again, that is 563-999-3698. Press number 1 and you'll be added to the queue. Please also like and follow my Lucid Libertarian with Lorianne page on Facebook. You can help me battle their freedom-loathing censorship by visiting my page regularly, along with reacting, commenting, and sharing my posts. Thank you so much for listening, but please sit tight and don't go anywhere. We'll be back in a few minutes to kick off the show.
Imagine waking up in a trunk. What is grooming? What if I told you we had a 40% increase of human and sex trafficking in our country due to COVID lockdowns? We already had high numbers to begin with. One's Purpose is an amazing organization pounding the pavement every day, helping these survivors get help. Unfortunately, they do not have the funding they need for a safe house. In the state of Oregon, we have zero safe houses for these survivors who have endured the most heinous of crimes. The time is now to get involved. The time is now to help stop human trafficking. Please go to onespurpose.com to get involved. If you need help and if you know someone who needs to get help, please contact 541-221-3448. Make a donation. Make a difference.
Sure, it's Friday night, but that is no reason not to tune in to NWCR Radio at 9 p.m. Eastern Time with Robert the Infidel Garding. Being around since 2007, we patriots have watched as the left and many on the right have done nothing to stop what is going on to destroy our great nation. Ideas abound with our society, but most are horrible at best. But there are good ideas out there if you know where to look. Join us every Friday at 9 p.m. Eastern for a dose of reality from behind the silver microphone of freedom with the voice of reason in this unreasonable world. That's NWCR Radio at 9 p.m. Eastern Time on Friday evenings, where you can call in at 646-478-5284 and give your solutions to what is ailing this country.
Home now, 70-year-old boys and their ideas fun. It's being
kid in a gang called the Disciples, high on crack, toting a machine gun. Church and kill everyone inside. You turn on the telly and every other story is telling you somebody died. Sister killed a baby cause she couldn't afford to feed it, and it was sending people to the moon. In September my cousin tried reefer for the very first time. Now he's doing hard. It's June.
I do. I care about future generations. I care about things. I want to do a song right now. I actually wrote this in April, and I'm going to keep singing it for a while because it makes me feel good. And so let's do it.
Hi, everybody. Gather around. I'm here to give you anything you like. You want free college, energy, mortgages, whatever you like. You have come to the right place. Why? I'll tell you why. Who can take your money?
Who can take your money?
With a twinkle in their eye.
A twinkle in their eye.
Take it all away and give it to some other guy. The government. The government can. Who can tax the sunrise? Who can tax the trees?
Who can tax the trees?
Let you run a business and collect up all the fees. The government.
The government.
Oh, the government can.
The government can.
And the government can, cause they mix it up with lies and make it all taste good. Just throw away the Constitution. I wrote that, thank you. Who can give a bailout?
Tell us to behave.
And make the founding fathers roll over in their grave. I don't care if you hate me, I'm going to sing it anyway. Oh, the government can. And the government can. Cause they mix it up with lies and make it all yum.
yummy, 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 yummy.
The government takes everything we make. They're all power hungry and malicious. Their economics are fictitious. Soon we'll have to eat our fishes. Chicken, how's that taste, kids?
Delicious.
Who can be a failure? In so many ways. And instead of getting fired, hey, we'll give ourselves a raise. Kentucky, you know what I'm talking about.
Oh, the government can. And the government can go.
I did the choreography myself.
And your Uncle Sam can, because he mixes it with eyes to make it still blue and good.
And I feel so good,
because the government says I should.
There. Are you hesitant to get the vaccine?
Yeah.
Then get the brand new government-approved Vaccinate Me Elmo doll.
Wow! Elmo loves experimental vaccines!
With the Vaccinate Me Elmo doll, your kid will finally feel the pressure and shame we've successfully made you feel to get the COVID vaccine.
Quick! Give me the vaccine! Elmo don't want to be responsible for the deaths of friends or family! Thanks! Ha! Now Elmo's a good person!
The Vaccinate Me Elmo doll comes with a toy syringe, a stethoscope.
Elmo, your heart is beating fast. Are you having complications?
Of course not!
And a tiny vial of something. It's not the vaccine, promise. It's, water. Let your kid drink it.
Elmo, can't you take your mask off now?
No! Gotta keep that mask on forever!
That feels like mixed messaging.
With the Vaccinate Me Elmo doll, your child will be begging you to get the vaccine. Just scared out of their little mind for the fate of the world or your money back.
It's your turn. Time to get the vaccine.
You want to.
Sorry, you have to.
No.
Do it.
No.
You have no choice.
No.
Now. Now. Or else.
Or else what?
Last chance.
And for all you anti-science conspiracy believing parents, buy the re-released classic Tickle Me Elmo. It's perfectly normal.
Now this is fun.
Get the vaccine or die.
Buy the Vaccinate Me Elmo doll today. It's required by the CDC.
The Babylon Bee Guide to Wokeness will teach you everything you need to know about how to choose your pronouns.
How to blame everyone else for your problem.
How to show the world just how wonderful you are.
The art of virtue signaling.
The basis of race, gender, and intersectionality.
The truth about American history.
Problematic books.
And how to tell if a baby is racist.
Freedom, love, and Sunday to everybody. You are tuned in to the Lucid Libertarian with Lorianne show. Thanks so much for making your way here. We already have Gunslinger sitting back in the switchboard, a Skype caller. We've got Boyd the Alaskan, Mike, also Gunslinger. We got Valerie all in the chat as well. So people are starting to funnel their way in. Hopefully everybody enjoyed their extra hour of sleep as we fell back, except for those in areas that, of course, don't observe daylight savings. Their life didn't change, but ours did. So, yeah, lots of stuff to try to talk about tonight. Valerie and I discussed a few possible topics a few days ago on the goings-on, and so I guess we'll just kind of throw things out there and see what happens. But there are some things, there's some Oregon stuff, and then, of course, national news and everything else going on. So any number of things that we will end up discussing tonight. In the show description, I laid out a few things. Sam Bankman-Fried was found guilty on all of the fraud charges this week. And so I think it's still pending the sentencing. And I'm also wondering, you know, if this being found guilty is going to lead to anything else. So that was an interesting development. So being found guilty, and after his own testimony, I think he basically sealed the deal. He was really horrible up on the witness stand from what I heard. Then mayors of New York City, L.A., Chicago, Houston, and Denver sanctuary cities are asking for $5 billion each to fund the overwhelming migrant inflows. They welcome them with open arms, but, we need more money. We need more money to take in all of these migrants. So, yay, goody, goody. And, of course, they're asking that of the federal government, so all of us are supposed to foot the bill for it. Congress this past week passed an anti-Semitism on college campuses bill, 396-23, and then they also passed another bill for $14.3 billion in aid for Israel, but Biden might veto it. I don't know. We shall see. That's because they separated it out. They didn't want to have a combination bill for both the Ukraine and Israel. So that's why Biden is having issues with it, because he, you know, wants a blank check to go to the Ukraine as well. Heaven forbid we actually separate that out. The National Archives located 82,000 pages of likely government-related emails from Biden's various pseudonym private accounts. So he used, you know, several different various email accounts, and likely a lot of it is government related, so there's a lot of sifting that needs to be done. But this is, you know, like a Hillary reboot. Like, you know, we thought Hillary's email scandal was bad. This has the potential to surpass even Hillary, believe it or not. Biden signs an executive order about AI development, making sure that it's not racist, in addition to a whole lot of other things. I do have that pulled up in a separate tab that I could read some of it and highlight some of it. So, Biden wants to, you know, make sure that AI development is not racist and get his hands in there via executive order. And then the Fed came out and basically said, you know, you don't like these high interest rates? Well, guess what? You're going to have to get used to it. They have no plans anytime in the near future to lower interest rates. So get used to paying more for any kind of loan that you get, credit cards, whatever. You're going to continue to pay more for that. Aren't you happy? Don't you love the Fed? Fauci NIH lab infected bats with the Wuhan coronavirus, obtained it from a zoo near Camp David. So if you remember a while back,
there was a lab found in California that was discovered. And so this story kind of caught my eye because now we're looking at this lab near Camp David, and they're tracing these things back. So I'm wondering how many more are like this. And, you know, and if you remember, gain of function is supposed to be illegal here in the United States, and yet it's looking more and more like evidence is coming to light that Fauci and his NIH labs were literally importing the Wuhan coronavirus in order to study it, in order to, make it more virulent, that kind of thing. And it's looking like there's more and more locations that are going to start turning up in the news there. So that's what I had at least in the show description to bring up. And hey, Jay Clark, I see you. Woohoo! Yeah, interest rates are up to 33% on new credit cards. Yep, exactly. We're paying the price for it. Like, seriously, if you don't have to take out a loan on anything right now, don't. I mean, you're going to be pretty much ripping yourself off. Save every penny you can. Use cash as much as possible. Yeah, it's not looking very pretty out there. And so with all that being said, Valerie, of course, has been waiting for me to finally shut up with the news and say hi to her. So, Valerie, welcome on. How's your week been?
Oh, it's going busy. No, I'm not waiting for you to shut up at all. So I've got my twin nieces and my nephew here. So I've got a busy house this weekend. I love them, but it's definitely busy.
Chaos and more chaos, but it's the good kind of chaos, all right?
Oh, it's the best. They're 4-year-old twins, and they are actually really they're really good girls. So, ironically, their older brother can be the one that's a little bit more of a handful at times. So you've got 2 9-year-old boys and an 11-year-old boy. Put them together, and I'll take the twins any day of the week.
Awesome. Awesome. I don't know how you do it. I don't have that personality. Like, the more kids, the more crazy I will become, you know.
Well, I've been doing childcare for
how you do it.
I've been doing childcare for over 15 years. So I've got 7 of my own. And then, you know, always adding more. And at one point I had up to 12 kids at once, and I love it. So it's definitely busy, but I enjoy it, and I couldn't ask for anything else. So it's definitely not for everybody.
Woman in my mind, anybody that can do that, because I know I am so unable to. I just, like, all the power to you, man. Thank God there's people like you out there.
It is called lots of coffee and lots of prayer. So, yeah, coffee and prayer are what keep me going.
And lots of counting to 10 before you blow up.
Oh, they're fun. As long as, you know, it's funny, though, because sometimes it's like, they'll all be great, and then all of a sudden everything falls apart at once. It's like when it rains, it pours. It's like, can y'all just – the nice thing about it is you get all of the chaos out of the way at once, but sometimes you're just like, can y'all space this out, please? Can we have meltdowns at separate times of the day, not all at once? But, it works out.
Like it's contagious. Yeah.
Oh,
and,
my goodness.
In the chat room, the Alaskan. Okay, now that you've laid out 12 topics that we're not going to talk about, where's the herd of cat going to go tonight? I'm the herder of
right?
cats, apparently. But we have more. That's just all the stuff that I could fit, you know, because of the character limitations, you know.
yeah, well.
We got more good stuff. I'm actually going back to Facebook to kind of scroll up a little bit on some of the things that we were going to we were going to try to bring up. Scroll up. In Oregon news, I guess maybe that's a kind of good strategy. Like, if we're going to, you know, bring up stuff here in Oregon, maybe do that at the start of the show before we start getting into, you know, everything else under the sun. A couple of the things that I wanted to bring up is, number one, everybody remembers a while back, we've talked about this before, but our former dictator, Governor Brown, suspended the requirement for math and reading and writing proficiency as high school graduation requirements, and that was only supposed to be for a limited amount of time. Well, Oregon suspended last week the graduation requirement for math, reading, and writing proficiency until the 2027-2028 school year, citing its discriminatory effect on minority students. It's racist. On Thursday, the Oregon State Board of Education voted unanimously to extend the benchmark pause, which was first instituted in 2020 during COVID. It was only supposed, you know, so basically it was up for expiration. And so now they voted it back in. So they've had all of this time. So the goal back when they first implemented it was to, you know, review the curriculums and make needed changes to make it less racist. So once again, we have our Oregon government that has had 3 years to make progress on this, and of course they don't, and so now we're going to be stuck with this policy for through the 2027-2028 school year, and fast forward in time, and we'll see if that gets extended even beyond that. Students in the K-12 system will not be held to an academic graduation standard for another 4 years. State school board members argues that the requirement harmed marginalized students who would often have to take extra classes their senior year to demonstrate mastery of reading, math, and writing, the outlet said. State-mandated standardized tests will still be administered to most Oregon high school students, but they won't be used to judge a student's graduation readiness. Other critics of the requirements claim they did not improve student outcomes after graduation. So basically, anybody that's out there, if you have kids that are going to school, either some out of the public school system, homeschool them, or don't move to Oregon or move out of Oregon to a state that will actually educate your child, because I just don't see how, if you graduate here in Oregon, how are you supposed to be placed in any kind of top-notch school? You know, these things aren't even... And meanwhile, you know, the proficiency of these things of reading and math, Oregon is really low. Forget that Oregon has dropped considerably in these standardized tests in just overall, you know, downhill in all of those categories. So we're probably the most, you know, it's one of the states that are the poorest educated. And it's, I think that this is just making a bad problem even worse. I don't know. What are your thoughts?
Well, I mean, I know we discussed the public school system quite a bit last week. The entire thing needs an overhaul. They need to get agendas out of the schools, stick to the basics, reading, writing, arithmetic, keep the politics out of it, keep the ideologies out of it. And I think that would definitely improve the school system. That would improve the test scores. Right now, goodness, they're focused more on just teaching to a test than they are actually making sure that kids understand. You know, all the Common Core stuff that they brought in was absolutely absurd. It confused kids more than it did anything. It that the school systems here are overall, they're really a joke. There's some that are, you know, they're doing well. There's some great ones out there, but generally those are your smaller ones. When it comes to removing these requirements, clearly there is a problem that they need to address. One, they haven't done it, obviously, if they're having to renew these, the removal of these requirements for graduation. So it makes me wonder where they're, well, I don't need to wonder where they're spending their time and energy, because they're focused on tolerance and equality and making sure that, you know, kids know how to use a million and one different pronouns and everything else, but they need to just get back to the basics. And my biggest issue with this removal of the reading or the graduation requirements is the fact that they threw, that they made it about race. Yeah, okay, so if you have these schools that are primarily serving minorities, don't insult them by removing the requirements and basically stating that they're the reason. Fix those schools. Look at it, and it's not that these kids aren't capable. It's that obviously what you're teaching, how you're teaching needs improvement. But it just, the way that they did it, the way that they went about it, just came across as such an insult to any minority group, any person of color. It just, it's an insult. I think it's a slap in the face, but that's what Oregon does best. They claim to be pro whatever you want to say, and then in the same sentence, they'll discreetly insult and tear down an entire demographic. So they don't.
Yeah, it's veiled racism. I mean, this policy is really veiled racism in a nutshell. You know, but we're doing it to improve the minorities, you know, but yet at the same time they're saying, yeah, but minorities aren't as capable of learning math and reading and writing. And so, you know, it's like, it's such veiled racism, it's not even funny.
And
they've been sitting here for this long. It's like, what have they been doing the last three years? You know, that if these school boards were at all competent, they would have a new plan in place by now. They've had three fucking years to fix it, and they have, you know, and nope, but now we need to extend it for another 4 years. Because that's how inept they are. They can't do their jobs. It's like, fire these people. Get them out. You know, like, what is their purpose?
I guarantee that if you were to replace all those making decisions with a bunch of homeschool parents, you'd have that done in less than a year. I mean, because you...
Oh, absolutely.
It just...
Absolutely.
You know, if they had to suspend the requirements temporarily in order to meet, you know... Whatever. I mean, if they had to suspend them temporarily, fine. I get that, because I'm sure that there's a lot of policy and funding stuff that's tied to it. But why put it on the backs of the minorities? I mean, that's just, it has nothing to do with them, and it has everything to do, they're a scapegoat is what it comes down to. They're using them as a scapegoat for their own failures. It's like, no, your policies and the curriculums that you're choosing and these requirements, that whatever requirements you have, that's what's failed. Your leadership has failed. It's not the fault of any of these kids. It's not the, for the most part, it's not even the fault of the teachers. The teachers are stuck having to abide by whatever guidelines are imposed or in place. You know, they can't. You know, if they want to teach their class the way that their class is best going to learn, nope, you can't do that because, well, this is what we're going with. It's, no, they're using scapegoats, and that's just typical government mismanagement and baloney and horse pucky and everything else that goes with it. So, yeah, but now this will make, what, 7 years?
I can't argue with you on that.
Yeah, it's
a joke. I'm going to go ahead and bring Mike and Boyd and Gunslinger all into the fold here. They've had their hand raised for a while. Don't want to alienate them. And I just clicked it. Okay, now it finally went. Hey, Mike, you're on. Boyd, hey. We got you on. Gunslinger,
hey.
You're on.
Yeah,
and I see Robert is in the chat and also kicking back on the switchboard as well. Welcome, everybody. Before I go on to the next topic, any comments on this Oregon policy? I'm sure you all are
yeah.
real big fans of it, right?
Yeah.
Oh, sure.
Oregon is successfully transitioning back to pre-Civil War education, to where the minorities, to where the minorities and the slaves in particular, were not allowed to be educated, and they are giving those standardized tests that they don't have requirements for, because they're making sure that they are not getting educated. Did that make sense to you?
Well, it makes sense
it
why
doesn't.
They would do it, but but it's idiotic.
Well, I didn't say that. I didn't say it wasn't idiotic, but it's successful.
Oh,
it's
yes, it
being
is.
Successful to they want to accomplish. They don't want any way, any shape or form an educated populace. They're doing this on purpose. They don't want the kids educated. A dumb populace is easier to control. Don't you
that's
realize that?
Yep, that's what I was fixing to say.
Well, yeah, you know,
if we
educate our kids here in Oregon, they might not grow up to be voting Democrats. They'd be too smart.
Yeah, they want the sheep. They want the sheep. They're the shepherd. They want the sheep. You know?
Yep.
The shepherd is generally in total control of the sheep. He's got his little staff with the crook in it and all that stuff to help him, and they know, and the sheep, all the sheep want to do is eat the grass, right, and get a nice full coat of wool and all that shit. And they want, that's all they want. They want sheep. That's all they want. You know, that's what they do.
What do you think of Ron Rick's famous quote is? We live in the land of retards. Okay? That's what they want. They want retards. Because like he said, retards are very easily controlled. Okay? Look around you. You're being controlled. So welcome, retards. We all are under this system. Go ahead.
And by the way, Gloria, you're just letting all the cats.
Yes,
yeah,
she did.
Which way is this herd of cats going to go tonight after we get off this education?
Yeah.
Well, Lori actually had a couple really good things to bring up.
Well,
I understand
all of those topics that she brought up. But, I mean, being just a newcomer here, as I am, I have noticed extensively that any of the topics that Lori brings up at the beginning of the show seems to be the only topics that do not get discussed on the show once the herd of cats get in the room.
It always happens like that, though. The show takes on a life of its own, that's for sure. You know, once in a while, like sometimes I will definitely have some topics that I really do want to discuss. And we will for a little bit, and then it'll just take a life. You know, the show has, you know, character that way.
Now, Laura, you mentioned the whole thing about the AI, right? the is one of the stories about the Democrats and the AI, right?
Yeah, Biden's executive order about AI. I did mention that earlier, and that's a topic that we can definitely back to since I have
It's as simple as this. I learned this a few weeks back from Bongino. What he said about them basically going after AI is, if AI is programmed correctly, algorithmically and correctly, it's not going to be on one side or the other, and because of that, it's going to call out their lies, and the media won't be able to set their narratives the way they want. They like to set their narratives with lies, so that's why that's why the Democrats going after AI. They want the ability to keep setting the narrative, and AI, like I said, if programmed correctly, it's not on one side or the other, and it'll call out lies and such things like that, right?
Well, it's only going to program for what they want to program. Have you got
right.
anything to say? Have any say in it? No. And that's the dangerous part. When you have them making all the decisions like they're doing right now and not even using artificial intelligence, look how stupid this country is running.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? Now, if they programmed AI, man, we would be up in a pit of hell, wouldn't we? Okay, if they had anything to do with the programming, okay? Because they're not going to use this technology for good, okay? When
mm-hmm.
has it, man... did anything that has benefited mankind overall? They got a cure for cancer. Are they using it now? No. They've had it for 40, 50 years, okay? And they're still keeping it a secret. And people are dying every freaking day, okay, from it. How is that helping mankind? Oh, it's a good population control. Oh, boy. Yeah, we're knocking people off left and right, ain't we? AI did the same thing. Good.
Yeah, it's pretty crazy. By the way, I put the link to the executive order in the chat. Executive order on the safe, secure, and trustworthy development and use of artificial intelligence.
According to
I'm sorry, go ahead.
I said, according to who? The safe, secure, and whatever of... according to who? Who's making the decision on whether AI is safe or not? That's the question.
Exactly. Yeah. Who are the gatekeepers of this? You know, I'd really like to know whose hands this is all going into. But I remember, you know, you got to scroll way down when it talks about the race aspect of it. And, you know, a while back I had watched, you know, several, you know, mini documentaries talking about AI and the initial development of it for facial recognition, for example, and it was found to be very, very racist, that it would, and it's because initially they were teaching the AI facial recognition using mostly white people's faces. And so, of course, the AI became pretty effective at identifying a white person's face, but was very ineffective when it came to minorities, you know, anybody that was black or Hispanic or Asian. AI got it wrong more times than not. And that's because of the way it was being initially trained to do. So I remember watching that kind of stuff, and that was one of the biggest concerns about using facial recognition, which of course is everywhere now. But you know, I think even part of it was mentioned there's like this, there's this one lady that's like an expert at it, and she spoke a lot about it. You know, Facebook using it, Google using it. That's one of the reasons too why I think that they abandon it. Because remember when like you would post pictures on Facebook and it would automatically like just, you know, facially recognize and auto rig people that were in the photo and stuff, and they don't do that anymore. So yeah, you know, it's like, okay, so we need, you know, these AIs need to be better, but this has been going on for a long time, and like all of a sudden now under Biden, it's a priority. Now at the same time, Gavin Newsom is pushing for like even more tracking and surveillance of kids in the school system. Of course, to, you know, better monitor and address their individual needs, of course, you know. And so, of course, I think this is AI related as well. You know, so Newsom really, you know, he wants to track every single thing, that, you know, from the time they step foot, you know, in kindergarten until they graduate, track every single thing. And, of course, it's, you know, for the betterment of society. You know, there's nothing nefarious there, right? Nothing to be concerned about. Y'all trust Newsom? Y'all trust Biden, you know, to have this kind of power? So that's what I think is the true goal, you know, is, you know, they're saying that, you know, oh, well, we got to be safe, you know, for cybersecurity and biotechnology and all this kind of stuff. And it's like, safe for who, you know? Safe for us, the people, or safe for the people that are developing it under the guidelines for the agenda that they want to push?
Did you read on that they proposed a bill of rights, a blueprint for an AI bill of rights?
Oh yeah, well, there's literally a transhumanist party that has a transhumanist bill of rights. Yeah, and they're incorporating that into this. Yeah,
for the AI, that safe and effective systems, you should be protected from unsafe or ineffective systems. Algorithmic discrimination protections. You should not face discrimination by algorithms, and systems should be used and designed in an equitable way. Data privacy. You should be protected from abusive data practices via built-in protections, and you should have agency over how data about you is used. Notice and explanation. You should know that an automated system is being used and understand how and why it contributes to outcomes that impact you. And then human alternatives consideration fallback. You should be able to opt out where appropriate and have access to a person who can quickly consider and remedy problems you encounter. I'm sorry, that should not be entitled a bill of rights. That is an insult to that. I am so disgusted. Like, it's the government.
Yeah, how do I opt out of an AI screening my resume? I'm having a, you know, like my resume does not actually get seen by human eyes. I can apply and apply and apply all I want, but you know, it's an AI AI screening bot that's screening my resume, and no human actually sees it. How do I opt out of that? How do I go, hey, when I put in my application to this, you know, potential employer, how do I opt out and say, no, you are not allowed to use AI software to screen my resume? I want an actual human being to do it. That's what I want to know.
Well, you don't get it. You're not going to get that. Now, here is something in regards to AI and the facial recognition stuff. I don't know about you guys, but my iPhone has facial recognition on it. I don't use it, and I won't use it, no matter how convenient it is. I mean, How often do you like to get ready to use your iPhone, and then you have to plug in your code to be able to get into it to work it? Well, they've got this facial recognition thing. All you have to do is point it at your face, and it'll unlock your phone, and you're ready to go without any hesitation. Okay. Well, I will not use that on my phone. And the reason why I won't use that on my phone is because your iPhone is learning. And what's it learning? It's learning your face. What happens with what it's learned of your face, over a period of time? It looks at your face from very many, 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 many angles that, you pick it up, and, if you pick it up and it takes a shot at the side of your face, as you roll it across to the front of your face where it'll unlock it, it now knows that when it sees that side of your face to go ahead and unlock, because it is you. It's learning.
Yeah, and what learning happens, your behavior.
What happens?
Learning
what happens,
how often
happens.
Imagine
what happens
the value
to all
of all
those,
that data.
What happens to all of the that photos and stuff that is being recognized by your iPhone to make it convenient for you to unlock it? All that stuff is going back into a database, which means that whenever they drop a photo and they want to do facial recognition, say off a surveillance camera, they have the data now to look at your face from any frickin' angle and be able to identify you from a side shot, from a front shot.
In addition to time stamps, location data, all of that stuff. How often you're using it, how often, where you're using it, what your patterns are, all of
it. I'm not talking about all that other data that you just mentioned. I am talking specifically about your face and facial recognition. So they can pick you out of a crowd of 100,000 people because they can look at everybody's face from every different angle on that photo of whatever and pick you out of the crowd. And that's just wrong for me. That's why I don't use that function on my iPhone, and I'm not too sure if my iPhone is still not in the process of taking all that information and data, but I'm not using it that function on my iPhone specifically for the off chance that maybe it can't take my picture and transmit it to somebody who could use it, to pick me out of a crowd,
Yeah, how do you know if, even though you might not be actually using facial recognition to unlock your phone, when you do unlock it, that it's still not recording that information. Your phone, it can still be capturing your image. It can still be recording that data without you even knowing, huh?
Yeah. It's like, your smart TVs nowadays, they got cameras in them. And, the only way to really secure yourself from your TV is to locate where the camera lens is put some tape over it. So they can't see what you're doing, where you're at in your house and or living room at any particular time.
Plus, what I would like to know is,
plus you don't want to see what Hunter Biden's doing anyway, you know?
Yeah.
But I would like to know, since the government, we know that the government's going to be utilizing AI, so what I would like to know is how they plan on adhering to their own data privacy that they put in the Bill of Rights, I mean, their AI Bill of Rights here. I mean, because it says that designers, developers, and deployers of automated systems should seek your permission and respect your decisions regarding collection, use, access, transfer, and deletion. We know they're not going to abide by that.
Well, there you go. You know, the Bill of Rights only secures the AI from civilians or people, you know, who would try to hack into it or whatever. The government, hey, we're not the general public. We can do what we want. You know, you got to remember all of that stuff. Just like when you go into the service. Yours is not to question why. Yours is but to do and die.
Mm-hmm.
I love this part of it. The term crime forecasting means the use of analytical techniques to attempt to predict future crimes or crime-related information. It can include machine-generated predictions that use algorithms to analyze large volumes of data, as well as other forecasts that are generated without machines and based on statistics such as historical crime statistics. Crime forecasting, pre-crime.
Sounds like Minority Report.
It does, doesn't it? It's like this is the birth of Minority Report right here.
Mm-hmm. Right, and that's the thing. And think about it this way, what you just said. There's this, me and Boy used to listen to this guy. I don't think he does the show anymore, but this other particular guy used to have a show. And one of the things he did was he was talking about what's her name from Chicago at the time, Lori Lightfoot, and he had this thing with all the crime statistics from Chicago called HeyJackass.com about all the murders and shootings and all. And it's just a bunch of stats, right? And it's like, okay, where did all those stats come from? Well, they came from where they came from, right? So it's like, what happens to a place like that has the actual stats from murders per year, murders up to date, murders this week, and all this stuff like that? And it's like, okay, if AI takes over that, will we get the actual stats or will we get something else? Right?
Yeah,
hello?
This is, I'm just kind of scrolling through this thing. This thing goes on and on and on and on. It goes into, you know, national emergency with a cyber attack event and all kinds of stuff. It's really laying out like everything that you've ever feared about AI. It's just like laid out right here for you. it's just amazing. Oh my goodness.
Can you imagine partnering that with the new Secretary of State proposal or whatever in Oregon right now? Or their request for proposals? They're, in that link that I shared with you where they are trying to, they're looking for somebody that can help manage misinformation, disinformation, and malinformation as it relates to election integrity. And so it's currently, and over the last 2 years, the Oregon Elections Division and county clerks have been targeted with a significant increase in burdensome public records requests, in many cases seemingly fueled by MDM, which is the mis, dis, and malinformation on the web, dark web, and spread on social media. False and unsubstantiated claims are frequently disseminated or amplified via web-based vectors in order to effectively promote accurate information regarding election administration and combat MDM. The Oregon Elections Divisions and county clerks must have the capability to detect and analyze this information. They currently do not have the capacity or technology support to track, follow, and trace all of the threats. And the use of the word threats there is actually interesting. I mean, because they started calling, you know, parents that showed up at school boards, you know, domestic terrorists, and now those that are going to be, sharing misinformation or whatever else they want to call it, those are now going to be classified as threats. Threats to what? And the fact that they have, they make a statement in here, a significant increase in burdensome public records requests. I'm sorry, that's part of their job. The people have a right to that information. If they request a bunch of it, well, do your job and get it to them. It's not burdensome public records requests. That's just,
I know. I love
how
they phrase that. Oh, it's burdensome. Somebody's asking for too much public information. You know, that's too much work.
Yeah.
I love it.
But yeah, Oregon is supposed to be all about transparency, right?
Let me ask you this. Who is your Secretary of State over there in Oregon?
Was it? Is it good? Ben? Or no? Who is it? Oregon Secretary of State.
LeVon Griffin Valade.
I'm just wondering because I know at one point that George Soros had a project that he wanted to get into office, secretaries of state, all right, to basically mess around with election laws and stuff like that. So if your secretary of state has any ties to George Soros, you guys are in trouble.
It's LeVon Griffin, Valade.
Mm-hmm.
She replaced Shemaya Fagan.
Mm-hmm.
So I have no idea if there's any ties there, but Shemaya,
no.
she lost her position after it being discovered that, well, she wasn't behaving ethically, put it that way.
I would assume she's a Democrat, right?
Yeah, she had some deal going on profiting off of legal marijuana or something. She wasn't she doing like something that favored a marijuana company that she was invested in, something like that?
LaModa? She was, oh goodness, what? Let's see. So she was providing consulting services as it related to LaModa's business or whatever. LaModa also made major donations to her election campaign. But I believe she was actually getting money from them. I don't remember what she was. I don't remember all of it, all the details. But basically, she was tied to a marijuana company that, and that they actually have, I believe LaModa actually has, people have found ties down to cartels down in Mexico, which wouldn't be surprising. Right. But
even better. I do have a Skype caller that's had their hand raised for a while. I think it might be Sarge. So I'm going to go ahead and bring that person in, not to interrupt. Hey, is this Sarge that we got or somebody else?
Well, if you wanted to be Sarge, I'll be Sarge, but I want to please you, Larry. I'll be whoever you want me to be.
No, you're all good.
Hey, look here. I've been listening to this conversation with great interest about AI, and I'm certainly going to agree with you that there are any numbers of AI. But I kind of like to focus on the identification aspects of AI, particularly facial recognition and other means to establish identity. And I'd like, look, if people in a particular state want to legislate against AI because they're concerned about where it might ultimately lead, that's entirely appropriate. They can importune their legislature to create the appropriate laws that are either restrict or forbid it, no problem. But I just like to say, I'd like to take a look at what we have and have had before AI came into being. And being a police officer, I'm kind of familiar with these methods. We had human memory and human identification, which, by the way, is notoriously inaccurate oftentimes for identifying people for probable cause when you don't have a specific name and a specifically identified individual. You have a general description, a white male, 5 feet, 11 or so, ruddy complexion, brown hair, something like that. Okay, well, that could apply to any number of people. And my experience with identification, particularly in a stressful situation, at best, it's 50-50. That's what we got now with human beings. And under oath, they will swear, and they're not lying a bit, that their identification was accurate. And it turns out later that the person they identified wasn't. We had sketch artists. And like with even the best sketch artists, if they get garbage in, you get garbage out. If the description given by the witness is inaccurate, then the sketch artist is going to be inaccurate. And then we had film, photographic film, which is a bit more reliable. But we know even photographic film is not necessarily dispositive of the individual that's purported to be identified. So what else have we got? We got fingerprints. Everybody agrees a fingerprint is conclusive, at least for establishing identity. We got DNA. Likewise with DNA. DNA is another conclusive descriptor. We got blood types. Well, get you in the ballpark, but it not won't necessarily isolate an individual. It just eliminate a lot of other people. So I would submit to you that even though your concerns in other aspects of AI are absolutely justified, when it comes to identification, I'm not so sure, based on what I've been looking and researching into, that artificial recognition is less accurate than human identification. In fact, in many aspects, it's even more reliable than human identification. Not saying it's reliable enough, but for purposes of establishing probable cause, I would say to you that it probably is as good as anything else we've got right now. And finally, when you talk about using AI to establish trends, well, that's what we do now. We predict trends in crime like anything else. We take a look at patterns that have evolved over time in a particular locale, and we look at other trends of people and even political trends, social currents, and we try to identify where something is likely to occur and then deploy the police resources to those areas that will minimize it. Now, we're going to minimize crime. Now, we're going to do that in a general sense. That's a good thing because that will allocate police resources where they are most efficiently needed. If we're going to do that for particular individuals, as you say, Lori, with regard to pre-crime to an individual, then yeah, I got a problem with that. But we already use CompStat, and CompStat, while controversial, have shown to be useful in certain locales that predict there's a crime and officially allocating police resources. But look, all I'm trying to say with all this is it's a mixed bag. I don't think we should be necessarily excluding it or including it. It's merely another tool that, like any of the other tools, is subject to regulation, oversight, to ensure it doesn't get out of hand.
Sarge, I agree with you on the policing aspect of it. You know, there's no doubt in my mind that it hasn't become an extremely reliable and useful tool in that aspect. And that, if it was limited into that arena only, I would be all behind it. However, the concern is not, to me, is not the use of the tool. It is who is using the tool and how are they using the tool. And in the last quite a few years, it has become quite apparent to many of us out here in the general world and population that all of these tools that we have put in place have been shall we say used in a manner that they were not intended to be used in. Just like the other night I was talking about shit about regulations and stuff, in that the legislature will write up a law we'll write a law. But at the bottom of each piece of legislation comes out with this statement or this paragraph stating that this law is intended for the secretary to then write up the regulations surrounding that law as to how it will be enforced, how it will be applied, and all of this stuff. And at that point in time, no matter what the intent the legislators had when they wrote the law and passed the law, the regulators, after they get that law, can change the whole meaning and purpose of that law and how it's to be and what it is to enforce.
Yeah.
That is
I share your concerns in that respect, man, okay? You and me are on the same page with regard to that. And again, that goes back to what I was saying earlier about oversight and regulation. It's like with any tool we've got. Look at computers, for God's sake. The very tool we're using right now. No one can deny that computers have provided overwhelmingly benefit for society and people in general. We all know there are legions of abuses that computers enable. There's no doubt about that either. And like you say, with the encroachment of artificial intelligence in the hands of people inclined to a tyranny, which, by the way, I think was a good title for your show, Laurie. But tyranny is something that tyrants unleash. It's not like they deliberately unleash it to bedevil the rest of us. Tyrants have control over tyranny and says, that they can turn it on and turn it off at will because they are, by definition, tyrants. So we can see what tyrants are capable of doing when they get unbridled, untrammeled power. And as Thomas Jefferson said, what's the price of liberty? Eternal vigilance. There's no way around it. There's no getting around it. We got to be eternally vigilant to stamp out every incipient bit of tyranny that has the potential to rear its head, which is why it's appropriate for us to have this discussion. But as we have this discussion, we need to consider all of these things in context and for the usefulness they provide that is positive. And I do believe artificial intelligence, particularly with regard to facial recognition of people in public spaces, can be useful to prevent crime, to catch terrorists, and maybe get rid of some of these illegal aliens that have been flooding in the country for the last 40 years. Maybe, if we ever get the will to do it.
Well, that is true. I mean, you can consider it a hammer because what was a hammer built for? It was built to hammer in nails and stuff that don't quite fit and all of that stuff. But yet hammers seem to be high up on the ranking of weapons that are used to kill people.
Yeah, more than assault rifles. More people kill with hammers than kill with assault rifles, so-called assault weapon.
Right.
Oh, yeah. Don't tell the anti-gunners that, though.
There becomes my concern over the use of AI because, you know, just like a hammer or a screwdriver or a chop saw or whatever, you know, they are great at doing what they were built for and intended to do. However, you know, you can use them for other jobs that they are great for other than what their intended use is.
Like a baseball bat.
So, you know, this is...
Yeah, AI the gunslinger, I'm going to tell you, all I'm saying is that all these concerns are warranted, and I'm glad people are raising them like you guys are doing. That should be done, and I hope it continues to be done. But I want to caution us of being like Luddites in this particular aspect because we know it's going to come one way or another. I don't think we can stop it simply because of the magnitude of it. I wish sometimes we could. I think a lot of times we implement technology without recognizing the full implications of it down the road, or maybe because of it, a lot of people want to minimize the likelihood of future consequences for implementing the technology. But still, again, I got to say, it's inevitable it's going to come. So get the appropriate regulations in place, elect the right of people in place, get election integrity, so we don't elect people who are inclined to be tyrants, and we maintain vigilance to make sure the damn thing doesn't get out of hand. I don't see any other way around it. This is coming whether we like it or not.
Exactly.
Well, yeah.
And hey,
I'm going to interject here because
we got Kat and we got Bianchi both raising their hand. So I want to go ahead and welcome both of them in. Bianchi, you're in the house now. Kat, welcome to the show, and now we have somebody else raising their hand here. I think it might be Nathan. Yes, it is. So I'm going to go ahead and bring Nathan in, too. Everybody's joining the party tonight, so welcome on board, everybody. Here come the cats.
Okay, now let me say one thing before all these other people jump in here. Okay. Now, hopefully these people who are jumping in here right now, we're here at the beginning of the show to hear the 12 topics that you put out for this evening show that we're not going to talk about because the herd is going to go someplace else.
Well, and then there's another topic that I wanted to inject in here, too, actually a couple of them. One of them is Oregon-related, and then another one is, I know one of our favorite topics is gun rights, and I'm pretty sure that that will probably take up the rest of the show. But here in Oregon, a while back, I remember talking about how here in Oregon we have like a severe lack of public defenders, right? So last year there was something like 300 cases that were dropped in Portland for lack of being able to provide enough public defenders to defend those cases. And so now the latest thing that came out is a federal judge has ordered Oregon counties to release criminal defendants from jail if they aren't appointed an attorney within 7 days of their first court appearance. The state is one of many that have struggled to ensure their public defense systems meet the requirement of the U.S. Constitution Sixth Amendment, and Oregon has faced multiple lawsuits over the issue in recent years. Ruling Thursday in a case filed this year by the Federal Public Defender's Office, U.S. District Judge Mitchell McShane said indigent defendants are essentially being locked up and deprived voice simply because they're too poor to hire their own lawyers. While the reasons underlying the shortage of publicly funded attorneys in Oregon are complex, all parties agree that the state is facing a crisis in its constitutional mandate to provide qualified attorneys to those charged with crime. Let's see, roughly 135 people were in Oregon jails without access to attorneys at the end of October, the judge said. Many of them had technically been appointed public defenders, but no attorney ever actually showed up to represent them. State laws generally require that criminal defendants have their first court appearance within 36 hours of being arrested, though that time frame doesn't include weekends. The ruling will go into effect November 16th. Judges in Multnomah County, which is home to Portland, routinely dismiss cases due to a lack of defense attorneys. More than 300 cases, most of them felonies, were dismissed in 2022. So here we go. And I predicted this. I don't know. Some of you long-timers might have remembered me talking about this last year when they released these 300 people and talking about the crisis that is not having enough public defense attorneys to represent all of these people. We have crime rates going up. We've got, you know, and the thing is, I mean, these aren't like, you know, small petty crimes either. You know, some of these are felonies. Some of these people are violent. Some of these, you know, and so now this is, you know, this is quite the conundrum here because, of course, yes, you know, you have the right to an attorney and, you know, you have the right to, you know, your Sixth Amendment right to, you know, speedy trials and all that. And so I, on the constitutional side of me, I support this giving a 7-day limit or they're going to have to be released from jail because why? The state is failing on their end, to make sure that people that, are financially struggling and cannot afford an attorney of their own get represented. So, you know, what do we do here? You know, how do we be constitutionally sound in this case while also protecting the public from, you know, potentially violent felons, you know, and actually prosecuting these people and stuff? I mean, this is just a Pandora's box of monumental proportions for Oregon, I think.
Quite frankly, I think that the people need to quit depending upon the state to protect and defend them from other individuals. It's easy to push that responsibility off on law enforcement and then complain when something happens, but most people are not actively engaging in defending themselves or learning how to defend themselves. You know, and so you create this public fear of what am I going to do if somebody, you know, tries to carjack me or somebody tries to rob me? Well, first and foremost, that is your job to defend yourself, and you have the right to defend yourself, so do it. that's as far as personal accountability. There's that. I mean, if there's a whole bunch of other issues that go into, you know, state management or lack of management when it comes to having public defense attorneys, but you know, yeah, if people don't have an attorney, then their rights need to be upheld. So kick them along. And if you're worried about it as an individual, learn how to defend yourself. Get to know people that you can call. Get to, I mean, you know, not every situation you can call somebody, but quit putting that responsibility to defend yourself on law enforcement. And half the time, they're not going to do the job anyway.
You know, here is one thing that, you know, you're all talking about a whole bunch of stuff, okay? There is one thing that nobody has mentioned yet as to looking into, okay? You need to start looking into the bar association in your state. Why the bar association? Well, you know, you just can't practice law in the state unless you pass the bar. Okay? If you don't pass the bar, then you can't defend somebody. So why do you not have enough people to go in and defend these people? Could it be that the Bar Association is picking and choosing who they want to be in the practice with a license so they can provide defense for somebody? I mean, there is a gentleman out there, David Strait, if you remember correctly, me mentioning him, claims and said that the Bar Association is who runs everything. Every fucking thing, because nobody can do anything without legal advice or legal intervention, you know, in business or in just damn near anything else. So if they don't like the way a certain individual may or does project themselves, you know, are they going to give the right decisions per the bar or not? Which means that person now does not get to practice law in the state because the Bar Association doesn't like the way they may or may not defend or work the law. So, you know, by hanging out, a lot of these people who just went through law school and stuff, the bar is maybe keeping them out of being able to practice law in the state so that you could have a good chance of having enough lawyers to be able to represent these people that they're throwing out on the street because they don't have a lawyer? And that'd be the simple answer for the state, that they have to do that because they don't have any lawyers.
Well, maybe, I don't know. I mean, should we require, okay, you know, everybody that's an attorney, doesn't matter whether you're a defense attorney or a prosecutor, if you're going to be an attorney here in Oregon, maybe you are obligated to take on X number of cases per month as a public defender. You know, maybe that's one area to do it. You know, I mean, you know, obviously, you know, if you can't afford an attorney, you need to have some representation. Our laws are written such that it is absolutely insane to expect the average person to be able to read and understand the laws and represent themselves. And so maybe that's it. Maybe, you know, some of these, you know, these rich, powerful attorneys, you know, maybe, you know, all across the board, maybe that's the most fair thing to do. Doesn't matter what kind of attorney you are obligated, you know, to take on X number of cases as a public defender to help alleviate this crisis and help provide the constitutionally, you know, protected attorney for somebody and then not have to just, you know, turn these criminals loose. And not all of them are criminals. I can't assume they're all criminals either. Just because they're charged with something doesn't mean they're guilty of it, right? You know, Pianki in the chat room is saying, you know, people that use public defenders should be required to pay for the service later. Maybe, but I think only if that person's found guilty. If the person's not guilty, you know, the person was charged, you know, with a crime that they did not commit. The police got it wrong. The evidence is wrong. They're not guilty of it. You know, how many times do we have, you know, abuses by law enforcement that just, you know, get the wrong person and that type of thing? Then, no. I don't think that, you know, if you can't afford an attorney to begin with, then, you know, how can you be expected to pay for that later on? You know, like you're just going to suddenly win the lottery and be able to afford paying that bill. You know, and I think that there's an obligation for when the state gets it wrong, you know, when they get it, when they screw up an investigation, when they get the wrong person, they, you know, they raid the wrong house, you know, whatever, and the person is arrested, then, you know, that was some of that financial responsibility does fall on the state. But I think that's a problem. I don't know. I'm just kind of thinking up, you know, thinking about whatever can help alleviate the situation.
Let me bring you back inside the box, Lori Ann. That would be a good thing for the state to require lawyers, any lawyer to have to defend any criminal who can't afford one. But, you know, that would take a legislative act to do that, and it will never, ever, ever, ever happen. Never, ever will your legislature pass that law.
Well, here's something else you got to think about, too. You don't want a prosecutor trying to defend you. Come on, that's like feeding you to the lions. What does a prosecutor do? They prosecute. That's what the goal of a prosecutor is. I call them a persecutor. Okay, they want your ass in jail, and you think I would accept a prosecutor as a self-defense attorney? I don't think so. I just might as well go ahead and just get me a rope and put my head in my neck and a rope, because they'll hang you. And it's proven every day. That's the bad thing about that.
A prosecutor and a public defender are both paid by the same people, you know. An attorney.
I mean, look, Ron Reck, who I don't know if Ron Reck's on the phone, but Ron Reck has always made the point that all the people in that courtroom are work for the state. The judge, the defense attorney, and the prosecutor, they all work for the same people, you know. So it is what it is with that. And we, until we figure a way to get this stuff done, and look, like you said, that law will never happen. You know why? Because we got a bunch of lawyers that run for legislatures. We got a bunch of lawyers that run for the Congress and the Senate, you know, in Washington, D.C. So
all our politicians.
Yeah, and the Bar Association itself, I'm sure, would lobby against anything like that, you know, too.
Yep.
Exactly. Valerie, look, you were about to say something. What were you about to say, Val?
A lot of people want tort reform, but it's never going to happen because it would cost the Bar Association and the lawyers a lot of money.
Let Lori, Val get in here.
No, I don't remember exactly what it was I was going to say. I mean, the entire topic is such a convoluted mess. I mean, you've got people that they can, the only people that they can have represent them in court has to be somebody licensed to practice law. So you can't, I mean, I'm sorry, there's some people out there that are just as knowledgeable about the law and court proceedings as attorneys as far as what would be relevant in their particular case. But yet you can't have somebody that you know or trust or whatever help you represent yourself in court. It has to be an attorney. So there's an issue. I think you should be able to, just like you can sign away your right to an attorney, I think you should be able to sign your right to having somebody else of your choosing represent you. That's one area. The other one that Lori touched on is the fact that, you know, you get charged for something falsely and nobody, the state's not held accountable in any way, shape, or form. And so people, if there was more accountability within the judicial system, especially with the DA's office, then I don't think we'd have nearly as many cases going to court. We wouldn't have as much of a need for public defenders because they would be making sure that they got their facts straight, not just going off whatever they want. One of the other issues that you've got is that was brought up is somebody mentioned they're all working together. If you ever go to court and hang out in one for very long, you'll notice that the attorneys are all friendly with the DAs. A lot of your public defense attorneys that are sitting there waiting to be assigned a case. I was in a courtroom one time and watching a public defender. He was reading a newspaper and talking to another gentleman sitting next to him and had to be reprimanded by the judge. And I was like, I felt horrible for whoever was going to be assigned to him because he didn't care. He was there just to fulfill whatever obligation he was. He didn't care about the person's rights. He was just getting by. And then you sit there and you watch them go out and talk all friendly with the DA. I mean, there are so many issues with this particular topic that it's just, I'm to the point with just about everything where it's, I mean, I mentioned it with the educational system, I'll mention it with the judicial system. You mention or bring up about any other system, I'll say the same thing. Wrap it all and start over. Because it's a mess, and there is not much that people can do.
And really, and guys, really, these lawyers weren't supposed to be able to become politicians. Constitutionally, it's illegal for a lawyer to be a politician, because they have a title, right? We want to get away from titles, and, you know, we got, you know, some of these guys go by Esquire and all that stuff, you know, and all that stuff. And then, of course, judges go, what do they call them? Your Honor. You know, they call them Your Honor and all that stuff. So, yeah, the title aspect of this stuff is there. And Just a side note about a particular AG. It's come out lately that Letitia James is worth $15 to $20 million. All right. Now my question is this: she's been doing is in the public, right? You know, she was a public defender. She was this. She's the AG of the state of New York. How did she get to be worth $15 million? How did that happen?
So you could easily tell how that happened, especially today. You know my old saying about the law, okay? You got to look at the law like a whore. The more you fuck it, the more the more you pay it, the more you fuck it, okay? And that's exactly what it is, okay? If you got money, okay, if you got money, you're set pretty much, okay? It depends on if they want your ass, okay? Even in some cases you have money, they're still going to send you up the river because you stepped on somebody's toes, okay? And that's the way it is. It's a toe-tapping deal. As long as you don't step on somebody's toes down there, well, you know, you got money, yeah, you'll get off, okay? But in most cases, you know, if you don't have any money, well, here's your public defender. Good luck on that one. The public defender is asleep at the switch over there and not doing a whole lot. And you're sitting there looking, hey, you're supposed to be representing me. Wake up, okay? I'm not a lawyer in this. I'm not a judge. You're the attorney. You're supposed to know. You're supposed to know. A lot of them don't.
Yeah, I like the point that Valerie brought up too, as far as you know me, if I should be able to choose, you know, let's say I have a very good friend that's a paralegal, or a very good friend that studies the law. They don't, you know, they're not an attorney. They didn't pass the bar association, whatever, but yet they're very, very up to snuff on reading the law and interpreting it and all that. You know, there's a lot of people that are talented out there that do that. And, you know, I should have the right to go, you know, this is who I want to represent me in court. There should not be a limitation on who I choose to represent me in court. If not myself, then I should have a right to do that, you know. And I think it's just another one of those corrupt ways where, you know, if that's required, that somebody has to pass the bar, you know, that in order to actually represent you in court, then I think that is one of those, you know, corrupt things. You know, that's part of, you know, sweetheart deals, you know, guaranteeing that, you know, you're not going to actually get the representation that you deserve because, you know, the public defender, like we said, most of the time, they don't give a shit. They'll make sweetheart deals with the prosecutor all the time. They are not vested in proving your innocence. The most public defenders want to do is make a deal. You know, we'll make a deal. You plead guilty, blah, blah, blah. And there's one less case off their docket. You know, the faster that they can just, you know, streamline this process, the better, and they work with the prosecutors to do that. And who gets screwed? You know, the person that needs defending.
Right.
Well, you know, they don't do their job. They don't care. Okay, they don't give a rat's ass about you. Whether they put you in jail or whether they keep you out of jail, okay? It happened to me two or three times, okay? I got arrested right here in the ditch for unlawfully carrying a weapon, okay, when we first moved over here. Okay, I turned around because I went out there to the box and checked the internet connection out there. And I was standing in the ditch, and I turned around, and the fucking cop had a goddamn 45 pointed at me, okay? I won the case, okay? But when I got out of jail on bond, I had to go and research the property lines of this property, which I found out, which went all the way to the edge of the road. So I was legally on this property, and he arrested me anyway. But I won the case, okay? But I had to do the research. My attorney didn't do it. I had to go down there to the county and research and pull the plat for this property and see where the property lines are, and guess what? The ditch was in it. Made him look like an asshole. Okay, so I won it, but look, I still had to do it. The attorney didn't do it, and this is supposed to be a defense appointed attorney.
Well, and here's the thing is a lot of your attorneys aren't even aware of what your rights are because it's not something that they know case law and precedent, and, you know, they touch on what individual's rights are, but that's not their primary focus when they're studying law. They are studying procedures and how to format things and different arguments and how you can this, that, and the other. But most of these attorneys, if they don't know what your rights are, then how can you expect them to defend you?
you know, hell, if I mean, there was a story quite a ways back where there was a bunch of cops that did something and tried to arrest somebody, and the guy quoted something out of the Constitution or something, and they had to go look to that, or quoted a law, and they had to go look the goddamn law. The cops had to go look the goddamn law up because they didn't know what the law was, right, Gunslinger?
Well, yeah, they don't know the law. Yeah, they don't know the law, you know, just like that cop. You know, they don't know the law. They tried. If you're going to enforce a freaking law, you need to know what it is, okay? Don't go out there and assume, okay, well, yeah, this is what I think. Well, no, it's not your deal to think. It's your deal to know, okay? Because look at it. Most cops, they're not attorneys. That's for damn sure, okay? Remember the old saying. Cops will give you false legal advice. Because they want you in jail. Go ahead. They would. You know that.
I got police officers are allowed to lie to you in the course of an investigation. The Supreme Court rule is not illegal, but police officers will lie to you in the course of an investigation. Well, of course, it depends on the state. State might have rules that forbid them from doing that. But as far as the United States Supreme Court and the Constitution, as they interpret it, a cop can lie to you during the course of investigation. I remember I had a guy at the burglary. He was a multiple-time offender. We knew he'd done it. We tried to get him to confess. We just took a blank tape, slammed it on the table, said, we got your ass on this tape. You're on this tape. You got your code. You might as well make a deal now and get a little bit of mercy from the state's attorney. Lo and behold, he took the deal. And we were lying our ass out there. And it turned out there's nothing in Illinois that's illegal about it. So never trust the police when they tell you anything and they're investigating you. Because here's what the words you need to say all the time. Lawyer. Lawyer. I want a lawyer. I want my attorney. I want advice of counsel.
I got an idea.
Just remember
it. You know, well, you know, it's getting so bad, you know, at this time, you know, in the times we're living in right now, that you have to have basically an attorney on call. I'm a member of Texas Law Shield, okay, because I carry a gun, okay? And if you have to use it in self-defense, you have a team of attorneys there. Bail money, the whole nine yards, and they'll represent you. Right there, I carry a card in my wallet right there. Emergency call. Call this first, then 911. And don't say nothing to the cops. Tell them I'll give you a statement later after I talk to my attorney.
And by the way, that guy confessed, told us where the stolen goods were. We went and got the stolen, got a warrant, went and got the stolen goods. Boom, had him dead to rights. But it all started when we told him a lie and told him we had him on dead to rights on videotape. And he swallowed it. He believed it.
Yeah, yeah. Shut up.
Stupid.
Be quiet. Don't say anything.
Don't say nothing.
Keep your mouth shut.
Don't say nothing. There's a reason why Miranda exists. There's a reason why Miranda exists. You have the right to remain silent, right?
Yeah. Let your lawyer tell you you ought to take a plea deal. If the cops got you dead to rights, your lawyer can find out. And if he's really a diligent lawyer, he's going to give you his best advice of counsel, and it may be in your interest to take a plea deal. If that's the case, you'd be wise. And he's a good attorney, by the way. And he's a good attorney. He knows what he's talking about. And he says, hey, it's in your best interest to take this plea deal. I want you to really consider it because that's what I think you ought to do. Maybe then you could consider it. But don't do it on your own. Let your lawyer tell you.
Well, and even then, if your lawyer tells you that, I would think twice and maybe consider getting a second opinion because half the time they're just ready to kick the case along and get to the next one. So
yeah,
you can't even trust your attorney to tell you to take a plea.
I'm assuming, though, you got an ethical lawyer, and there are ethical lawyers out there. And if you got an ethical lawyer, and they're good ones, and they're experienced, they're going to give you their best advice and counsel. It's going to be pretty honest. But again, that's contingent upon you finding an ethical lawyer. Because no matter who the lawyer is, no matter how bad a scumbag you are, It is a legal obligation to give you the best advice or counsel that protects you against the prosecution of which you are being accused.
They're
ethically bound to do that, and legally, for that matter.
Yeah, but unfortunately, they know that people can't really do much about it if they violate those ethics. I mean, people, there is recourse, but most people don't know what that recourse is. And then how do you prove it? Because then you're just working with more people that work with attorneys, yeah. And they kind of circle the wagon.
Yeah, they do. They're very insular. But, you know, I have seen many cases where lawyers have been either brought up on ethical charges or certainly court cases being reversed because of illegal malfeasance and a bad advice of counsel. So, I mean, I've seen it. It happens. But you're right.
Oh, yeah.
Most people don't. It's like everything else in the system. Most people don't know what they could avail themselves of. Anyway, I don't care what you're talking about. When it comes to any aspect of the Constitution or any aspect of their right, the right to speedy trial, or any of the other aspects of the Bill of Rights, most people are just not aware of what they have at their disposal.
And think about this, Sarge. You're talking about ethics and ethics charges. The biggest example of that is what's going on in New York with Trump and this judge and Letitia James and all this stuff, where it's obvious that this judge should be brought up on ethics charges. It's obvious. And so should Letitia James. It's obvious that both of those two people should be brought up on ethics charges.
Oh, no doubt. I've never seen a person running for a major statewide office campaign on the notion they were going to get a specific individual. Now, yes, I've heard them say about things that could be identified with a specific individual, but I cannot recall hearing them mention someone by name and say, the reason I'm running for office, or one of the primary reasons I'm running for office, is to get this individual, absent any specific evidence to cite as to why they should. I've just never heard of it before. And she got away with it.
Well,
so far, anyway.
So far, yeah. And that's the thing. And this judge may very well get away with it, but we'll see. Because he's got his own ethics problems, the judge, you know. And Schumer's tied into this as well, but that's a whole other argument. But all these cases against Trump have ethics problems, least of which Jack Smith and what's-her-name, Fannie Willis, down in Atlanta. They all have ethics problems. You know?
Do they ever? All of them.
Because
they're
politically
rats.
Motivated.
They're just corrupt rats.
I'm going to take the opportunity right now. There is about 6 minutes left already. I know time flies. 6 minutes left of the live broadcast. So if you are out there and you're listening and you want to join us as we go into the bonus hour, call in now, 563-999-3698. And then you can kick back and listen, or press 1 and raise your hand, and I'll bring you on into the conversation. And then also stay tuned for all the great shows here that we have on Blog Talk Radio with the various hosts. On Mondays, there's American Statesman. Her show is usually 7 p.m. Eastern Time on Mondays. Tuesdays, there's Joe Gibson's show, same time, usually 7 p.m. Eastern Time, Restoring the Republic. And then Fridays, of course, I co-host on Conservative Nation Media with Robert on his shows on Friday nights, 6 p.m. Pacific Time, 9 p.m. Eastern. Then we have Donnie C's show. His show is on Saturdays, Beyond the Mainstream, also 6 p.m. Pacific, 9 p.m. Eastern. We have Ron Reck. He usually throws on a show kind of late night, around 8 p.m. Pacific, 11 p.m. Eastern throughout the week. We got Jay Clark, Jay Clark Novelty. He usually does a show midweek, you know, Tuesdays through Thursdays, also a late night show. So check him out. So we have a lot of great hosts, a lot of great conversations here on Blog Talk Radio to follow. And then, of course, make sure to carve out time on Sunday nights right here at Lucid Libertarian. And then there is another topic that I wanted to try to segue into, you know, talking about ethics and everything. A big Supreme Court case is coming up on Tuesday that they are going to be hearing. And it has to do with the constitutionality of the federal law that prohibits firearm possession or ownership, you know, of those that have a protection order, a domestic violence protection order against them. So this is a pretty big case. And I do have a clip that I wanted to play that kind of Armed Scholar on YouTube, and he outlays he does a good explanation of the background of this case. And then I have a feeling that we're going to want to discuss this because I have some opinions about this, and I'm sure everybody else will too. So it's a rather, you know, not a super long clip. It's a total of 10 minutes, but I probably won't play the entire thing. But he really lays out the foundation of what this case is about, and it is coming up on Tuesday. So anybody that is a gun rights advocate, anybody that has feelings about gun rights and protection orders, we're going to want to be paying attention to this. So I'm going to go ahead and kick off this clip right now. And then now's a great time, as I said, to call in. There's about 3 minutes left to do so if you haven't already. And let's discuss this topic as we go into the bonus hour. So here we go, 3, 2, 1, and launch.
So this week on Tuesday, the Supreme Court will hear oral arguments on the next landmark Second Amendment case. So let's talk about what's going on. But real quick before he jumps this video, if you think it's time for the Supreme Court to strike down more gun control laws, go ahead and hit that like button and subscribe. Also, I want to thank the sponsor of this video, which is Sonoran Desert Institute. SDI is an accredited online college that helps students learn the skills and techniques they'll need to be successful in the firearms industry. So if you enjoy gun repair, ballistics, and learning about firearms, SDI might be a good option for you. To find out more about SDI, you can visit the website linked down below. And thank you again to SDI for sponsoring this video. As I mentioned in the intro, in this video, we're going to be discussing an important Second Amendment case that will be argued this Tuesday, November 7th, in front of the Supreme Court. That means that the Supreme Court will hear and rule on the new Second Amendment case before the end of their term. The case is called U.S. v. Rahimi and deals primarily with the question about who are the people, as mentioned in the text of the Second Amendment. In this case, the government was actually the ones who sought Supreme Court review because the Fifth Circuit recently ruled that the federal prohibition on gun possession for people subject to things like domestic violence restraining orders is unconstitutional under the Second Amendment. In that critical decision, the Fifth Circuit three-judge panel analyzed the federal law 18 U.S.C. section 922 G8 under the Supreme Court's recent 6-3 decision in that New York State Rifle and Pistol Association versus Bruin case. Bruin requires that a government's restriction on the right to keep and bear arms must have a historical basis or analog that dates back to 1791. If it does not, then the law must be struck down as unconstitutional. The Supreme Court has granted review to this case and will hear the case this week and then decide if they want to strike down this federal law prohibiting the possession of firearms for anyone with a domestic violence restraining order. This decision also has huge implications for other cases because we will get further clarification essentially by the Supreme Court on how the Bruin analysis should be applied going forward in similar cases and other cases. This case will also be critical to outline who are the people under, you know, the Second Amendment and who are the people protected by the text of the Second Amendment. The primary question of this case is whether Mr. Rahimi, because of that domestic violence restraining order, does in fact fall outside the class of the people afforded Second Amendment protection. So that is one of the big questions that's going to come out of this case, but then there's going to be a lot of other things that are going to be answered. Now, the facts surrounding this case are not great, and I want to state from the outset, Mr. Rahimi is not a good person. There are plenty of other things Mr. Rahimi should have been convicted and arrested for, but that's kind of not what's at play in this case. So between December of 2020 and January of 2021, Mr. Rahimi was involved in 5 shootings in and around the Arlington, Texas area. On December 1st, after selling narcotics to an individual, he fired multiple shots into that individual's home. The following day, Mr. Rahimi was also in a car accident. He then exited his vehicle after the accident and then shot at the other driver's vehicle. Then in January, Mr. Rahimi fired multiple shots in a Whataburger restaurant when his friend's credit card was declined at that restaurant. The officers in that Arlington, Texas area identified that Mr. Rahimi was a suspect in multiple of these shootings, and they obtained a warrant to search his home. The officers executed the warrant and found a rifle and pistol in Mr. Rahimi's room. And then on contact with Mr. Rahimi admitted that those were his firearms and he was in possession of those items. He also admitted to the police department that he was subject to an agreed-upon civil protective order, which was entered in February. And again, that was entered in by a Texas state court, and that was involving the alleged assault of his ex-girlfriend. That protective order restrained him from harassing, stalking, or threatening his ex-girlfriend and also their child. The order also expressly prohibited Mr. Rahimi from possessing any firearms. A federal grand jury on review of all these issues ultimately found that Mr. Rahimi was in fact possessing a firearm while under a domestic violence restraining order, and therefore he violated federal law 18 U.S.C. section 922 G8. Now, early in his case, he did bring a challenge to that federal law, and he challenged it as unconstitutional. However, he lost the initial argument since the Fifth Circuit's precedent had in fact prior found that under the interest balancing approach, that federal law was constitutional. He then appealed that decision up to the Fifth Circuit, who again found that that type of argument was foreclosed because of their precedent. But then the Supreme Court issued that critical and landmark Bruin decision and reaffirmed that text as informed by history and tradition is the proper analysis when you're looking at these types of 2A cases, and you should never use interest balancing. So that kind of reversed all the things that the Fifth Circuit had done prior with their precedent. And then the Fifth Circuit panel in the Rahimi case withdrew their prior opinion and then re-reviewed the case and ruled under Bruin that their precedent was no longer valid and that this specific federal law, which prohibits the firearm and ammunition possession by someone subject to that domestic violence restraining order, is in fact a violation of the Second Amendment. In reaching their decision, the Fifth Circuit panel stated that the government fails to demonstrate that Section 922 G8's restriction on the Second Amendment fits within our nation's historical tradition of firearms regulations. The government's proffered analogs falter under one or both of the metrics that the Supreme Court articulated in Bruin as the baseline for measuring relevantly similar analogs. Obviously, that decision did not sit well with the government, so then they sought Supreme Court review. They filed a writ of cert to the Supreme Court. The government actually decided against going to the Fifth Circuit en banc panel because prior to the Fifth Circuit en banc panel, and likely still, is not in the government's favor, so they decided to bypass that and go directly to the Supreme Court. And then at the end of the Supreme Court's last term, right at the end when they were doing some cleanup orders, we received news that the Supreme Court did grant review to this case. This is significant not just for 922 G8 and that specific law, which is in question in this case, but this decision will have broader implications to all other cases and will likely be cited in all other 2A cases going forward. The decision here by the court will have to apply Bruin and that analysis against 922 G8. That means we will get further language on when gun control laws like this meet the text and history standard, which was outlined in Bruin. Also, this case and decision will center around who are the people, as stated in the Second Amendment and the text of the Second Amendment. And this Tuesday, all of this is going to come to a head. The Supreme Court will hear oral arguments on whether this federal law is in fact unconstitutional under their recent Bruin decision. The question presented to the Supreme Court, which they have granted review in and they will consider, is whether 18 U.S.C. Section 922 G8, which prohibits the possession of firearms by persons subject to domestic violence restraining orders, violates the Second Amendment on its face. So there are some really interesting arguments made by Mr. Rahimi and his attorneys in their brief, essentially saying that this type of federal law does not fall in line with Bruin at all, though there is no historical or textual support for this type of restriction, and that the founding generation would never have allowed this type of nationwide categorical ban on the possession of firearms, of ammunition, and similar items, especially based on this kind of loose civil protective order. Now, also in their brief, the attorneys here tried to limit the situation to just the issue at hand. So a lot of the other factual stuff about the other incidents that Mr. Rahimi was involved in did not really involve in this case. Yes, he is a bad actor, but some of those things did not actually align with this specific issue. A lot of that stuff was thrown into this case to show how bad of a person Mr. Rahimi is and kind of to try to just muddy the facts and make this seem like a really bad case. This is very important because this is not just an as-applied challenge. That means that the Supreme Court will not just decide if the federal law is unconstitutional as it applies to Mr. Rahimi. Instead, the government's question presented to the Supreme Court is an actual facial challenge and a facial challenge to the federal law. That means that the Supreme Court will decide if the federal law on its face is unconstitutional for everyone, not just Mr. Rahimi. So this is going to be a very interesting and landmark case going forward. This is a critical case, and that's why I think a lot of people are excited to hear what the Supreme Court says during this, you know, oral argument coming up this Tuesday. The anti-gun side wants to use this case as a tool to place limitations on Bruin to stop a lot of these Second Amendment legal actions that are happening right now, and they're trying to stop a lot of the wins that we've got. We've got various wins by circuit courts after Bruin. We got rulings essentially like on controlled substance prohibitions and the possession of firearms if you're under controlled substances, and then also nonviolent felon restrictions. So we've got a lot of wins post-Bruin, and the government hopes that a positive ruling in their favor in this case will help to kind of constrain Bruin. Now, I think this Tuesday we will also get some further insight into how some of these justices want to apply Bruin and what they believe about Bruin going forward. There have been some question marks surrounding some of these justices like Justice Barrett, Kavanaugh, and Roberts. The oral arguments will be potentially very helpful to show us how these specific judges want to apply Bruin going forward and what kind of their 2A sentiments are. This is also important since the Supreme Court has just granted review to the Cargill bump stock case, which again challenges the ATF's bump stock rule. Oral arguments here will help us predict maybe what the justices currently feel about Bruin and the 2A topics in general, and could also help to frame some of the briefs in the Cargill case going forward. So again, very significant, not just for this issue at hand in this specific case, but all of their 2A cases going forward. So if you guys have any questions, go ahead and comment down below and I'll try to answer the best of my ability. If you like this video and like supporting the channel, one of the best ways to do that is to like, comment, and subscribe. All those things help to fuel the algorithm, and it signals to YouTube that you guys see value in these videos and in this type of 2A news.
Yeah.
All right. Sorry, really? I had to cut it off at the very end there. But that was Armed Scholar. Follow him on YouTube. But this is a very interesting case, as you can see, and he laid it out way better than I ever could. And so before I start getting into that, I'm also going to unmute Joe Gibson, who has his hand up, and then Robert Egner. I'm going to unmute you, but stay muted on your end if you don't want to talk. But I'm sure that if, at some point you're probably going to want to chime in on this topic. So let's what are your guys' thoughts on this case about protection orders and the constitutionality of it?
Laurie, this law was an outgrowth of the Lautenberg Amendment, which was unconstitutionality applied on top of another unconstitutionality with the Hughes Amendment to the Federal Firearms Act of 1934 forbidding the federal registration of any new automatic weapons. So it, what it said was that anyone who would be convicted of even a misdemeanor violation of any domestic violence law was forever prohibited from ever owning firearms again, and it even applied to members of police forces and the armed forces. This thing is a true constitutional monstrosity. As we said, it's got no basis in either tradition or history of the United States. And by the way, I'm not for forbidding convicted felons from regaining their firearms rights once they've done their time and been released from all court and prison supervision. I don't see, because first of all, no law prevents a felon from getting a gun somehow if they want to commit a crime. They're not going to be stopped by any prohibition anymore to stop from anything else that criminals do. And if we're going to say that criminals have the right to regain their right to vote, I don't see why the Second Amendment should be a lesser constitutional right. So I say
I
be
agree.
Consistent when it comes to it in all cases.
I agree with that, Sarge. A felon should have the right to own and maintain a weapon. And here we go again. We vote locally. We vote state. We vote federally. And now we listen to judges. Judges don't make laws. That's some crap.
Well, you know, you got to. I'm for it too, as long as it's, they keep it in their house. But they're going to be prohibited from carrying it, like here in Texas, constitutional carry, or even if with a permitted in permitted states, you're going to be denied the right to carry that gun if you're a felon. Okay, now you have it in your house. Yeah, you got no problem with that. Everybody got to protect themselves, you know. But you really don't need one if you went to prison, say for armed robbery. That's a gun, armed. Okay, and you're convicted of a felony, armed robbery. Is it a real good idea for you to have a gun? Think about that.
Yeah, but why? Well, why? Wait, well, wait a second. Hang on. What's his sentence? When you're convicted, what are you sentenced to? Life in prison or life? If you're sentenced to 10 years, you do your 10 years, you're free to go. That's it. Why you got to be a life sentence, you know?
No, I don't say it.
Well,
yeah, I mean,
see, I feel the same way.
Why you become a lesser citizen? Because you've been convicted of a crime. Now you're a lesser citizen.
You've done everything you're obligated to do, then it's done. You know, restricting your ability to own and possess a firearm as a punishment for a crime is perfectly valid. But once your punishment is done and over with, then that's it. Then all of your other rights should be restored. And does that look pretty? You know, guess what? Sometimes, you know, us having the rights that we do does not always look pretty. But it doesn't have to. That's not the point of it, right?
But,
and when it comes to protection orders, I can see the intent, but number one, protection orders oftentimes aren't even enforced, you know, in prohibiting firearm ownership or possession by the, you know, by the person that the protection order is against. That's not going to stop a damn thing either. They're going to still probably have it, you know, they're probably or be able to acquire a gun some other way. They're probably, you know, if they want to kill their ex-girlfriend or their ex-wife or whatever, they'll find a way to do it. And so, you know, there's nothing prohibiting him. Like you were talking about Hammer earlier, you know. Well, you know, if he doesn't have the gun, then, you know, take a big old hammer and that'll do the job too. I mean, these laws are going to do absolutely nothing to prevent a damn thing. And yet, you know, it just looks better and sounds better to support these restrictions, especially when it comes to for life kind of thing. It's like, oh, okay, because I was violent when I was 20 years old, that means when I'm 50, I'm going to still be a violent person? No. You know, that it's one of those things. Like there should be no such thing as a life sentence against your rights. You know, once you've done the time, unless, of course, you get a life sentence for murder or something like that, obviously, then you're going to spend the rest of your life in prison. But, you know, I'm just talking about other crimes, you know, armed robbery, whatever the case may be. I don't believe that you know, your constitutional protected rights should be forever taken away from you.
Well, I remember the case in Chicago where the Chicago police were escorting a woman to her home, and they had taken her there because she was afraid of her boyfriend. So two police officers came with her to her house, and they waited on the front porch while she went in to get some of her things because she said she was afraid of her boyfriend and she wanted to move out of the house and go. Now, the boyfriend knew the cops were there. When she got in the house, he killed her. And they sued the cops for not protecting her. And the courts ruled that no, the police wanted no obligation to protect her because she wasn't in their custody. So, look, folks, even when the cops are there, in this particular case, two police officers could not protect a woman from being murdered by her angry boyfriend when they went there to escort her to her home. And then they weren't liable for failing to protect her because the only way the courts ruled you can be held liable for failing to protect an injury, an individual from death, a serious bodily harm is when they are in your custody, formal custody, for whatever reason. It was astonishing. That kind of a mixed mind about the protection order. I think that if the protection order involved, it comes about not simply because you're being annoying, but because you made an actual physical threat or attempted to carry out an actual physical threat that carries a possible prison sentence, you know, against a specific individual, as a temporary restraining order and even the confiscation of your firearm, I'm not that troubled by that particular instance. I mean, I could see arguments both ways, and I haven't absolutely made up my mind on the subject, but I can kind of see it in that particular narrow instance.
Well, that custody example reminds me of illegals and immigrants. Unless they are under the jurisdiction of the United States. But actually, they are under the jurisdiction where they came from. If they had problems, they would go to the embassy of the country where they come from, not the U.S.
Yeah, but one thing for sure, though, I think no one should have a life sentence against the loss of their constitutional rights when they are beyond the purview, the day-to-day ordinary purview of the judicial system and the criminal justice system, when they're not on probation, parole, or anything else. They're as protected by any of the other Bill of Rights as any other citizen. They all should be restored. I mean, I'm kind of reluctant to say that, but as a matter of principle, I cannot believe anything else, just on principle.
Yeah, but the victim never thinks that the punishment is severe enough. What about the victim and the victim's family?
Well, we're talking about, I can understand that after that person has done something and the courts didn't do anything that might have prevented it, but certainly not before.
Well, yeah, I mean, you can get a protection order without a crime even being charged, right? You know, so there's, you know, there might be an accusation or a threat of domestic violence, but that doesn't necessarily mean that domestic violence has actually occurred. So with a protection order, you know, is the victim really a victim? You know, if it hasn't occurred, you know what I mean?
Again.
And therefore, is there actually a crime there to restrict somebody's firearm use? To me, that says no. And I think that this case, too, opens up the door for questioning red flag laws at the same time. Whatever they decide on the constitutionality of restricting firearm ownership and possession for a domestic violence protection order, I think will also apply very strongly toward red flag laws, which I am against. I will put that out there right now. I am absolutely against red flag laws. That is actually my hope, that whatever this decision is, that it will be applicable across the board to similar restrictions like this.
But then again, did a restraining order stop O.J. Simpson from killing Goldman and his ex-wife? No. So, because, you know, sometimes those restraining orders aren't worth the paper they're printed on.
Well, look at Blake in Minneapolis when he showed up at the birthday party that the court had told him that he's off limits. He had a restraining order of being in the vicinity of that woman. The police came after she called him, and he ended up getting shot. I don't know if he was paralyzed because he went in his truck, his vehicle, and got a knife as a police officer was trying to stop him from going in the vehicle.
Mm-hmm. Right, and that's the point. Now, should these protection orders be worth anything? Who knows, you know? If they can't enforce these things, if the guy's got anger problems, he's just going to show up there anyway, what can you do? I mean, and they're not under any obligation to protect you. So that woman was taking her life in her hands anyway because she didn't have a gun on her person to protect herself, you know? And I'm going back to this previous case, you know, where the woman ended up dead because they were under no, you know, thing to protect the woman, you know? So that she wasn't in their custody, in other words. So anyway, but yeah, this could have... I mean, look, I'm still waiting for if a lot of these cases eventually lead to the overthrow of the Firearms Act of 1934, I'm all for it. Let's go. Let's get rid. Let's have decision after decision after decision until we end up working our way back to the Firearms Act of 1934.
And
1958.
Yep. Well, at some point in time, the states is going to say, we're not going to do it. And until then, we're going to, like the end of that skit that that Laurie played, the words he said, this going forward, that means you're going to have it go on and on and on and on. It's going to be a hold your breath, hang on to your seat, and see what they say. That's a bunch of bull crap.
Mm-hmm. And you see, even when they slap people down, some of these states don't listen to them. Look at what fucking New York did with the New York Safe Act. Oh, we're going to slap that son of a bitch down? All right, we'll just reword it and pass it again. You know, that's what they do. That's what these people do. They're going to want, they have an envy for destroying the Constitution, and they want these gun laws so that they can take away the guns from the people.
Who's they?
Right?
You're right. That's what the governor of New Mexico. That's what she done. Did she say she's going to do another one until she get it right? Well, then at what point in time do people do a recall and get her ass out of office?
You're going to have to ask Robert that. I don't know. You know, I just don't get these liberals. And it started a long time ago, but it really got started when the whole thing with Gabby Giffords, you know, when she got shot and shit. That's when, you know, it really got started, you know, with the whole, you know, this got, now granted, they didn't do a damn thing when Steve Scalise got shot at that baseball game. Not a goddamn thing, you know. So go figure, right?
Yeah, you know, talk about, like, I can even see how this case with laws that require, you know, safe storage of firearms, for example. Like, if you're going to put the Bruin test to this, could obviously negate that requirement. You know, oh, you have to have it locked up. You have to have an approved safe. Like, that's what some of these states like California and Oregon want to do. You know, you have to have an approved safe that meets these requirements, and you have to store them like this. You know, even in your vehicles, you know, city ordinances where, you know, if you don't have a concealed carry permit and you want to carry your firearms in your vehicle with you, then the firearm cannot have a round in the chamber. The magazine and the firearm itself have to be separated. They can't be within, you know, reach of you as the driver. All of these restrictions, you know, like if you apply the Bruin test to any number of these things, it'll all get shot to shit, literally. You know, I mean, it's completely unreasonable to expect people to do that, you know, especially when it varies from county to county. It's like, oh, I'm about to cross the county lines. I better do a Google search and see what their requirements are for me to actually drive through it, you know, or pull over at a gas station. I better make sure that I'm complying with how I'm storing it. You know, it's ridiculous. So it's like, I hope that all of this stuff comes crumbling down, you know, when you apply the Bruin test.
Yeah, you know, you guys remember reading or hearing about the first mass shooting by a psycho I could think of that really hit the national news, and that was Charles Whitman down in Texas at the University of Texas at Austin. And he climbed up in the tower and started shooting. He killed 19 people, wounded about another 30 or so people. Anyway, what prevented him from doing more killing than he otherwise could have, because he was an excellent marksman, was the fact that so many people were running around in Texas at that time with rifles and shotguns in the back of their pickup trucks. And they immediately went to the campus, or they were already on the campus, retrieved the rifles and shotguns from the trucks. And you can see in the documentary films of the time, the gunfire hitting the Texas tower that kept them pinned down and making effective use of the weapons he had on hand. Most of the killing that he did, he did within the first 3 to 5 minutes of shooting. After that, a riled up citizenry, just ordinary citizens, started shooting back in dozens of them. And you can see all kind of bullet hits around his position that kept him pinned down and kept him from making effective fire. Now, the police were on the scene. None of the police were trying to disarm any of these civilians. They were up there with it because most of the weapons they had were mainly shotguns. They couldn't even reach the tower. You know, their long rifles they had, and forget your handguns. And it was the citizens that had the rifles that were actually able to effectively engage them from 300 to 500 yards on a slant upward distance. So they kept him pinned down while the police went up the tower with another civilian who was an Air Force veteran to take the guy out and kill him. Now, this is before they had all the SWAT teams and everything else in Texas and all that, and it was before they made a lot of other laws. But believe me, at the time, the police didn't have any problem with all these ordinary citizens shooting this guy who was killing people on the Texas campus. It was an amazing story, which they never want to cover that aspect of it. They completely neglect to report that part of the incident. But if you go back and look at the documentary films, you will see all them bullet hits going up from where the citizens are shooting back at Charles Whitman and keeping him effectively pinned down.
You know, Sarge, you're absolutely right. One thing that's for sure, no criminal, I don't give a damn how crazy he or she is, wants to be shot back at.
No, for sure. That I know.
That wasn't at the Capitol building, though. It was down at UT in the main building, the tower.
Say it again.
You said it was at the Capitol building. It was at UT at the main building. There's a tower down there. He went up to the top of that tower, which anybody could go up to at that time.
Yes, that's true.
Yeah.
But he was definitely so high that the police shotguns could not effectively engage them. They just didn't have the range, even with rifle slugs. So with all those citizens that had their hunting rifles and everything else that could make up the difference, they were actually able to hit the tower and keep them pinned down.
Well, you know, another thing, too. Nobody cares about the Democrats' little darling city, Chicago. First week in October, 46 shot, 2 killed. The second week, 25 shot, 4 killed. The third week, 31 shot, 5 killed. The last week, 34 shot and 4 killed. On Halloween, 15 shot. They don't say anything about their little darling.
Yeah. No, they don't. Then why would they say it? Because now the narrative doesn't fit. They can't find a way to blame it on white supremacists. I mean, if they could, they would, believe me, but they can't. That's why that's another reason they just don't want to talk about it. I mean, I've never seen a press that is so hostile to fact. I mean, they're just hostile to fact. I mean, they're determined, for the most part, to push narratives, editorial slants on news reporting. And if they can't figure out a way to spin it, they simply admit the things that are inconvenient for them to report. So we're stuck with this.
Well, this country is going through quite a upheaval right now because the hypocrisy of the left is totally being revealed as being the real fascist in this country.
Mm-hmm. For sure.
Yeah, to Bianchi's point, I'm looking at these stats here. Year to date, shot and killed in Chicago, 498. Shot and wounded, 2206. Total shot, 2704. Total homicides, 557. That's just in Chicago, year to date.
And I can guarantee bloody to you, the overwhelming majority of them were killed by someone with a firearm who right now, under existing Illinois and federal law, is legally prohibited from possessing a firearm or even a single cartridge of ammunition.
Yep.
Well, one thing for sure, didn't no police officer shoot nobody during that time.
That's for sure.
And nobody talked about this.
Yeah.
You know, that lets you know that these authorities, the elected officials, there's something going on. We probably don't hit on it. We just won't stick on it. They're a bunch of corrupt, evil people with an agenda.
Well, you know, Chicago Chicago law enforcement has been corrupt since the 1920s and 30s. So, yeah.
Well, Chicago is a corrupt city. And, yes, there's been corruption in Chicago Police Department. At times, it's been endemic. But let me tell you one thing about the Chicago Police Department. I believe you're absolutely true. Not only from my personal experience from it, but studying the history of crime in Chicago. The police, Chicago Police Department has always been able to get a handle on crime spurts when they occur. They have always been able to tamp it down, pumped up about public disorder by crime. Corruption, yes, that's always been a part of Chicago police life. But I'm talking about public disorder caused by crime. The Chicago Police Department has always been effective in keeping it down to the sort of levels that the public expects to tolerate. And whenever it started to get out of hand, by normal policing methods, we were able to do what was necessary to ease the public's mind about rampant crime. That is no longer true today. It is completely, the paradigm is completely shifted. People in Chicago do not think the police department is capable of getting a handle on this. This is something I don't believe heretofore has never existed, not even during the days of Al Capone and the Beery mobs, because on most part they were killing each other.
Well, let's
you know,
be
you
realistic.
Bring up a good point. You know, there, what we're seeing is people starting to realize that more government is not working. You know, in every single case, more government tends to create more problems than it solves. And so, and that's the hypocrisy is, you know, all these anti-gunners, you know, they don't realize that when they're advocating for all of these gun laws, they're actually advocating for more government. Well, at the same time, they wanted to defund the police and, you know, stuff like that. And then the same is true for the right. You know, the people that support red flag laws, they want more government involved in these things, even though they're supposed to be conservative and be for limited government. They don't see the hypocrisy of, you know, it's like just like the war on drugs, this war on guns is going to end up the same exact way. It's, you know, it's going to be millions upon millions of dollars going toward this effort, and it's all going to blow up in their face, and it's all going to be inefficient. It's not going to do a damn good, and it's only going to lead to more and more government encroachment, bigger and bigger government. It's just feeding the beast on both sides.
Well, that's especially true when government gets involved in spheres of public life where it has absolutely no business, and correspondingly, they reduce its influence in the areas where it's supposed to have a predominant role, like maintaining public order and enforcing the law. I mean, the basic constitutional law. That's especially true. That's what we're witnessing right now. We're getting government where it has no business being involved in our lives whatsoever, a ruthless expansion of government, and then in those spheres where it is supposed to predominate under the Constitution and our understanding of government, they cut it down and they eliminate border enforcement, law enforcement, the penitentiary judicial system, the probation system, the parole system, the court system. That's where government is supposed to do its work and leave us alone for the most part. But they are abrogating and neglecting their duty in those spheres.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. And then, like, going back to even our public defender crisis here in Oregon that we started the show with, basically, it's like this is what leads to it. All of these laws that people are advocating for and that get passed and stuff, guess what? They have to be enforced. And when people break it, then this is how we end up with a crisis where we're going to have to be releasing people and dropping charges because there's just simply not enough public defenders to handle it. There's probably not even enough actual lawyers, you know, out there to handle the caseloads, even if they're paid, you know, and you can't afford it. It's like it's overloading and taxing the system, and I don't think enough people really realize it. And it's like people don't realize how this breaks down that relationship with the public and law enforcement. Every single one of these laws that get passed, every single one of these laws that gets enforced, well, they're the ones that have to do it. They're, and that means more interaction with the public. That means, you know, more aggression is going to be needed, you know, in order to, you know, in order to keep up with it. And so the relationship, and therefore, leads to the public not trusting the police. And it's like,
you know,
this,
Laurie,
this is
I used
like
to ask
over
people
and over
question.
And over and over again.
I would ask people a simple question. When they wanted a new law to be implemented, and they obviously they hadn't thought through the consequences of this new law they're asking for. I would ask them, look, I'm an armed agent of the state. I said, look, do you want to give me the authority to kill you or someone else in the course of enforcing this law? Now, notice, I didn't say because they passed a law, a dog leash law, and I get to kill you because you're violating the dog leash. I said, in the course of, meaning you either resist my enforcement efforts, resist my efforts to arrest you. In the course of that arrest, I have to use deadly force to protect myself or someone else. Now, I would ask him, do you want to give me the authority to kill you or someone else in the course of enforcing that law? Now, if you're okay with that, then I'll say you have the wherewithal and the proper state of mind to at least ask for the law that you want to be implemented. But if you have doubts about it, then you don't need that law.
And Source, that's exactly what happened to Trayvon Martin. When he decided to attack George Zimmerman and did what he did and put him on the ground and started bashing his head into the ground, he took his life in his own hands and he lost.
Yeah.
You know, this guy, when you got guys that are that way, that actually make that move to be aggressive towards you, what choice do you have? You're not going to say freeze, you know, all this stuff. You're not going to do that. You're going to, well, I don't want to say shoot first, ask questions later, but again, what choice do you have? If they're being aggressive towards you, what choice do you have, you know?
Look, the man had a laceration on the back of his head. He said he thought he was about to pass out. If he passed out, the odds were high that Trayvon Martin gets his gun and kills him with his own gun. Of course, I mean, it's perfectly reasonable and objectively reasonable to assume that you need to use deadly force to prevent that happenstance from occurring. Just the act of the physical force being employed against you is more than enough to justify deadly force against anyone doing such an act. Forget all the drama and the emotion and the narratives. That in and of itself objectively constitutes a reasonable use of deadly force against an attacker.
Right.
Some of these criminals that's absolutely guilty should be publicly executed. Publicly executed. They're guilty. What's the use of executing them behind closed doors and listening to a generator speed up when the switch is pulled? That way you put a deterrent.
It has no deterrent effect. It's like some kind of shameful act we're hiding from the public. Are we ashamed of the fact that we decided to execute people in certain areas? It sounds like we're ashamed of what we're doing. If we're that ashamed of it, we shouldn't have the death penalty. I don't see any reason to be ashamed of it for certain crime.
Right.
That's a whole other topic of discussion. See, I'm against the death penalty. It's like if you don't want the government to have this much authority, you know, more and more and more authority. Well, the ultimate authority there is to give government and our corrupt system is the ability and the authority to end somebody's life as punishment for a crime. That's the ultimate authority right there.
But,
and I'm against it because, you know what, with as corrupt as our system is, as often as they get it wrong, me personally, absolutely zero tolerance policy for putting to death somebody that was not guilty. They're later found that they were not guilty. Evidence comes out later. You know, you got corrupt politicians, you got corrupt judges, you got corrupt prosecutors. You got corrupt law enforcement. You got evidence that isn't allowed to be presented, that the jury never hears, and they find the person guilty by mistake, and that person is put to death. Well, once they're dead, you can't undo that. You know, and if that was done by mistake, that, you know, I have a zero policy for that. You know,
that's
zero policy.
Well, if you have cases where it's
I studied it pretty closely, and I do understand what you're saying with regard to certain people who have been sentenced to death and later found to be innocent. Now, I've seen many cases where that is true. I have not seen a single case in the 20th century where a person who was executed for a crime, where subsequent evidence was shown unequivocally that they were innocent of the crime for which they were executed. I've been looking high and mighty for such cases. I have yet to find one.
Look how often somebody that was put to death is posthumously found not guilty because new evidence comes to light or evidence that was suppressed originally from the case that the jury never heard. It happens more often than you might want to, you know,
I'm
aware.
I've never seen such a case where the person was executed. I've seen it where they were sentenced, but never where they were executed. And I'm still looking for a case that would show that.
I've got an answer for that one.
Documentaries on it.
I have an answer for that one. If somebody was executed because of evidence not being presented or whatever, and it was found to have been withheld, then it's like this. It's very simple. The prosecutor who brought those charges and didn't do full discovery, or anybody that was involved to keep evidence out so that this person would be executed, would summarily themselves be executed.
Oh,
take them out, yeah, that's criminal
just
malfeasance.
Take them out
there,
and summarily though. Execute them.
Yeah, well, you're talking about something
that's
criminal
it.
There. Doing that is criminal.
And they, because they were holding a position of authority and trust in the community to uphold the laws of the community, they should be taken out and publicly hanged.
Well, I'm not going to argue with you on that one, then, because that is criminal. And if a state decides it's to such a penalty, so be it. I wouldn't have that much of a problem with it.
Now, wait a minute. Government, now you're going back to giving government the authority to just practice barbarianism now. I mean, y'all are not logical at all, but that doesn't make any sense, boy.
Well, I know two cases where a criminal stood over police officers and shot him dead.
There is officer down
in St. Louis and another officer down in Baton Rouge, Louisiana. The criminal stood right over him and killed him. Those people need to be publicly executed.
Yes. Barbarity is a show of intent and a show that those who will want to do this think again, because this is what's going to happen to you. It's not going to be pleasant. You're not going to have somebody stick a needle in your arm and then give you chemicals to kill you. You're going to be painfully put to death.
Well, in about three generations, this country is going to be under Sharia law. So, you know, we're going backwards. We're not going forwards. So there you go. So the things you're talking about and proposing just feeds right into that type of barbarianism. We've got to be better than this. We have to set the example. We have to go back to our founding fathers. We have to get back to what the Constitution says. If we don't do that, if we don't go back to the basics this country was founded upon, we're going to lose it all. We can't sit here and wish things to happen. We really have to try to be more civilized.
But then again,
Cat, let me say, I am for going back to our founding fathers, because in our founding fathers' day, public hanging was all
sure.
there.
I'm not talking about what public the people did. Oh my God, I'm talking about the founding fathers. They didn't publicly hang anybody. They, of course, there was barbarianism type, local justice being served back then. I understand all that.
There was public execution all over the country when necessary.
The founding fathers, there's nothing in the Constitution about public executions. I'm not talking about what people in the country were doing. Our country has been improving. If we go back to that type of justice, then we're going backwards. We're not going forwards, and we're going to lose it.
Well, the Constitution does have a negative endorsement of the death penalty in the Fifth Amendment. It says that no person shall be deprived of life or property without due process of law, meaning that if you receive due process of law, you can be deprived of life or liberty. So the framers clearly were not against the death penalty, per se.
But I'm not talking about the death penalty. He's talking about what the fuck? Y'all changed the subject all around. That's not what I meant at all. Boyd said that we should be able to use prosecutors or officers of the court to withhold information that ends up getting somebody killed that was innocent, then we should go out and publicly hang those people. That's what I'm addressing. I'm not addressing any.
Yeah, that's like expanding government authority, not restricting it, Yeah, and I get what you're saying, yeah.
Oh, okay. I see what you're talking about.
And, Lori, I want to address one other thing. You said earlier something about that people should have whoever they wanted to represent them in court. The purpose of not having a non-lawyer representing you in court is actually for the defendant's protection, because if there ever is an appeal, there are certain things that you can't appeal on if the person who represents you in court is not an officer of the court. Then you don't have any appeal. So actually,
but that should be up to the right of the individual. The right of the individual that is being charged with whatever, they should be able to determine who it is that represents them.
Why?
Because it's their life at stake. That's their choice. That's not up for the court to decide.
Then that person has to be an officer of the court. Unless that you are representing yourself pro se, which means representing yourself. So therefore, if the case is appealed, there's no basis for appeal if the person representing you screws you up. Plus, it's to protect the defendant. You all don't understand this concept because you're not looking at wait a minute.
Here's the thing with that. Here's I guess you could say my argument to that one. So just like a pro se individual, well, they can't appeal a decision because they didn't know this, that, or the other law. So why can't they have somebody else? The same standard would apply just because the person that they chose to represent them didn't do the greatest job. Okay, you can't appeal it based on the person that you chose to represent you.
Because that person would not be an officer of the court. You have to be an officer of the court.
That's the way it currently states. I mean, it currently states that you have to, but why should you have to? It's up to me how I choose to defend myself.
Okay, if you know someone who could defend you but who is not a lawyer, then you could get that person's advice and enter your motions yourself. That's the way the court looks at it. Trust me.
Well, perhaps that person can argue a case better than yourself. I mean, if you can basically sign away your right to appeal by representing yourself, then I believe you should also have the ability to sign away your right to appeal by having somebody else represent you.
Well, it depends on the grounds that you're
appealing. I should be able to hire somebody like Dave Champion. He is not a lawyer, but the guy studies the law like you will not believe. He probably studies the law better than any attorney out there. I would rather have the right to go, hey, you know what, Dave Champion? Will you represent me in court? Will you effectively be my attorney? I should have the right to be able to do that, because you know what? I would trust some more somebody like Dave Champion to defend me more than this piece of shit public defender that makes deals all the time with the prosecution, with the prosecutors, and has no bone in the game. You know, they don't care about me, you know, that kind of a thing. Or one of my, like I said earlier, my best friend that might be a paralegal, very, you know, very skilled at looking up law and understanding it and stuff. I should be able to go, you know what, I'm going to trust my best friend that has a legal mind like this, even though they haven't passed the bar and they're not actually an attorney. I'm going to probably have more faith in that best friend of mine to represent me better than some jerk off, you know, that's never met me before and has no skin in the game.
Well, if you're going to, you've completely waived the right to an appeal. Now, if you're pro se, you may waive the right to appeal on the basis of ineffective advice of counsel, but the way a lot of jurisdictions get around that is that if they allow you to be pro se, they do appoint a co-counsel that is an officer of the court to sit with you, even though you make all the decisions in the case, that co-counsel sits with you to give you advice.
And Kat, I'm not saying that that's not, you know, that that's, I understand the way things are currently stated, like how they have to be, but what I'm saying is I don't believe that they should be that way. I mean, if we're talking about, go ahead.
What you're saying that, what, you can't represent yourself in the appellate court system? Is that what you guys are saying?
No.
I was saying that
I believe that an individual should be able to choose somebody else that is not a licensed attorney to be able to represent them if they so choose. Just like they can choose to represent themselves pro se, they should be able to choose to have somebody else represent them. I don't, yeah, they, you know, and Kat, I'm not picking on you. I just consider, you know, look at it as more like healthy debate, you know, differing of opinions, not a
right,
big deal.
Right, I just wanted
I
you to look at it from the other side.
One of the, you know, things that you mentioned was an officer of the court, and that term just kind of sticks with me because we're talking about a corrupt judicial system or a judicial system that is not just. Why should I be required to utilize somebody that is a part of that system instead of
and why
that
should
I
you
trust.
Lose your and why should you lose your right to appeal when they made the rules and laws by committing extrinsic fraud against you, denying you the right to have your will mutually and reciprocally and included?
Well, let me ask a question then, sir. Think about this for a minute now. Now you're being pro se and you're convicted while you were pro se. And then you decide to appeal because let's see, I want to appeal my conviction because of ineffective advice of counsel, which is me. Now think about that for a minute. And that's the basis of your appeal, ineffective advice of counsel, and you are the one who insisted on being your own counsel. Now how exactly does that work out?
I don't think it
well,
does.
When you,
I think you have to have counsel in order to appeal a
That's why they
that
appointed co-counsel. That's the reason they do it.
Well, and they could still, even if you were to choose somebody to represent you, they could still, you know, appoint somebody if they had to meet whatever requirement, you know, just to fulfill their obligation. But the way it stands right now, you can't have somebody else represent you other than a licensed attorney. You can only be pro se or participate in their system.
It would be chaos in court if you allowed this. You would open up so it would be chaos. The judge would have to – the judge bends over backwards for pro se litigants anyway. So if you have somebody else in there that's not a lawyer trying to try a case before the judge, they can walk all over you. They can – you just won't even know what's being done to you. For one thing – the judicial system is very incestuous. All those people know each other. They know both sides of the cases. They've worked in law firms. They've worked in prosecutor's office, or else they know people. it's just a swinging door in the judicial system. So
the whole system is rigged against you because of the fact that when you go to school, you're indoctrinated to be a nobody unless you have the means to become a lawyer and to join that bar association. And then you're pushed into going by their way of doing stuff. So therefore, you don't get to truly look for justice and truth and represent your client for, you know, what is true. And if the person wants to have legal representation, but they need to switch because they found out that the lawyer is corrupt and then they have to switch again, there should be never any opportunity for an oligarchy of criminals like our bar association group to dictate to you and me that we can't dictate to them what those rules and laws ought to be. And that's what they're doing. They're saying we're the specialists, we're the experts, and that's why we've designed these rules, laws, processes, and procedures of the different levels of courts, and is going to go by these rules and whatnot. Well, you're screwed unless you can afford the lawyers. Have you? Well, put it this way. Well, I ain't going to. I know this.
So how do you figure that we're not?
I've sat through a few court cases, and I've been for 2 years in a class action lawsuit before. I've worked with lawyers, and I know how to turn the light switch on, so to speak, but I don't know how the doggone electricity works. But the point is there's a whole lot of rules and laws and processes of that system that you were never given your right to have that consented to. So now you're exposed to the fraud that they wanted to you, and if the lawyers that you get involved with you buddy up with them, they got backroom deals and crooked side deals to screw you over in a heartbeat. And that's the system taking advantage of you, and we're indoctrinated through grade school all the way up to college these days to be a part of that corrupt system and let the elites manipulate us.
Exactly.
We have the best. We have the. Wait a second. We have the best judicial system in the history of the world, in the United States. It's not perfect. There is a lot of corruption. I understand that. The best cities operate best when they have a partnership, when law enforcement has a partnership with organized crime in that city. For example, Dallas. You don't see a lot of things happening in Dallas that you see happen in Chicago, because it's well known that the Dallas Police Department has to operate with organized crime in that city. Organized crime
Do you mind if I ask, have you ever had to deal with the judicial system in criminal matters or know somebody close to you that has?
Oh, yes, I have.
And have they been represented fairly by their attorney?
Yes.
And the DA?
You got to ask it from the people that actually sit in the court that were the defendants or the plaintiff. Somebody that just was a friend to somebody or knows somebody don't really understand the true reality of what that's all about.
So I guess one of the things that gets, you know, and sometimes people have had great experiences and things have turned out great. But unfortunately, many people have had negative experiences, in which case you've got the attorney who does a horrendous job of defending them and is more interested in just getting them off their caseload or getting paid. You've got a DA that only cares about a conviction rate, and you've got a judge that is tired of hearing cases and wants to get through the day and get home. There is so much. And while you might have a great – go ahead.
No, go ahead and finish. I thought you were stopped.
I'm going to hang up because every time I talk, I get interrupted. And, you know, apparently I don't know anything. So good night, y'all.
Hey, Kat, we enjoy hearing – I at least enjoy hearing your perspective.
I do, too,
Stay on, Kat.
You know.
Even if we disagree, it's okay.
Yeah, and just jump back in there, Kat. You're just as important as anybody else here.
And here's the thing is, even if we disagree, you're making all of us think. And that's important. It does us no good to sit there in an echo chamber where everybody agrees with each other. So we need to be able to have these conversations.
And guys, a lot of times with the court system, the crime isn't the crime. The process is the crime. Look at what they're doing. Look at what they're doing with Trump. It's not about the crime. It's about the process of going after Trump after in these court systems. It's the process. The process is the crime. So, yeah, you got these people that are all these people. I mean, look, we know what happened with Ken Paxton, and he was a lawyer that may have been a little crooked, but he went against a cabal of other people that were supposedly more powerful than him, but he won. All right, he went against the Bush cabal, right, Kat? And he won. Now, I'm not saying he's crooked and he's not crooked, but he won. You know, so these are, because he went after, first off, he beat George P. in an election. That pissed him off, and he's a Trump guy. That pissed him off again. So, I mean, look, a lot of times with these things, it's the process. You got to have a process. You got to know what the process is to get any semblance of justice in the situations. Guys?
Well, do you guys realize that I haven't looked it up to verify what I'm about to say, but do you know that to be a judge, you do not have to be a lawyer or a member of the bar to become a judge?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, there is no requirement of having to be a part of the bar or be a lawyer in order to be a federal judge. No requirement at all. And then Kat, I don't know, Kat, did you hang up or are you still with us? I'm just double checking because my switchboard is, I'm blind. But I just, you know, I think that Kat sometimes, you know, she's more soft-spoken. She doesn't have like a loud, boisterous voice like myself or several others do. And so I think that's why sometimes she gets talked over.
Yeah. I think she's gone. Maybe.
I would prefer to go into a courtroom where I knew that the judge was not a lawyer.
Mm-hmm.
And then go into a courtroom where the judge was or is a lawyer when he got his job. You know, the judge is there to maintain order and stuff. And, you know, like I said, you do not have to be a lawyer to be a judge.
I would give a caveat to that, boy.
Which then opens up the argument for, like, then why does it have to be somebody cast? Why should I be restricted on who represents me based on that? If a judge is not required to be a lawyer and pass the bar, then why should somebody that I choose to defend me have that requirement?
It depends on the state.
Well,
some states do require it, so you got to look at the state. But look, I would want a judge to know what type of evidence is admissible and not. I mean, I would want a judge in there who admits hearsay evidence and doesn't understand the exceptions to the hearsay rule and allows evidence to the court that is not an exception to the hearsay rule or something similar. So even though I don't think they have to be attorneys, they do have to be schooled in the basic constitutional aspects of the law to ensure that there's a fair trial.
You're all wrong. Being a to be a judge, you have to have a minimum of 5 to 10 years of experience in a legal profession. You have to pass the bar exam and other relevant tests, having a good reputation and character, applying for a judgeship, or being selected by a judicial commission or authority. So it's very difficult to become a judge.
Where are you reading it from, Joe?
By whose law?
Everything I've read says that there's
now,
no constitutional
what state
requirement.
What state is that in?
There's
what
no
state
legal
is that
requirement
in?
For it.
All 50 states.
They've all got it,
Reverend.
Yeah, on here, I just pulled it up as well, and there is there's quite a few different locations where, I mean, like, constitutionally, there's no set requirements.
True.
But the basic requirements for becoming a judge is, I just looked it up. But, undergraduate degree, LSAT, Juris Doctorate, pass the bar exam, practice as an attorney. Not every type requires it.
Let me ask you something.
Okay.
My bad.
So, go ahead.
Can I get in here?
Yeah.
Okay.
Go ahead.
I don't know every jurisdiction in all of the 50 states, but whenever people want to be a judge and they campaign to be a judge, when they go down to file their paperwork, does the people at the state or Secretary of State, I don't know where you're filing for that stuff, it may be at the same place where you file to become a ward representative or any other official in your state, does it tell you what you have to be eligible or have already, or acquired these levels of education and experience? In my world experience, there is none. You go fill out the paperwork and you tell them who you are and you're wanting to campaign to be the judge, and then whoever votes for you, if you get the most votes, you are the judge, dude.
Well, you got to look at the state constitution first, though, because the state constitution is going to tell you what the requirements for any elected official are. You got to start there. That's where you have to start. What are the requirements for elected officials in your state?
A municipality ordinances lay out the qualification for a judge. And no, you don't have to be a lawyer.
And the election board does. Yes, you do. You have to
have
requirements.
Joe Gibson, I was the mayor of Hillsdale, Missouri, and I helped write the ordinance.
You
did not have to
from,
be a
Beyonce?
Lawyer.
What
to
state
be
are
a
you
judge.
From?
You know,
okay,
what
so there's state? Only well, 20. There's only 28 states that require all judges to be lawyers.
Absolutely. Then a municipal judge that hears the ordinance violations of the municipality. They don't have to be a lawyer.
And that's an administrative judge. That's called a magistrate in most jurisdictions.
32 states allow a person without a law degree to become a judge. 32 states.
True. I thought it was something like that.
Because
you
don't have to have
and
some
you gotta remember,
graduate degree.
You
don't
the
have
state
to have
constitution a gives the requirements
yeah,
for all elected officials to include judges.
You got common court judges, where it's the people in the community
there's
that
no
do
common
the judging.
Law courts in this country. There's no Article III courts.
And
there's no common law courts.
You stay
what are you
in South
about?
Carolina, and I'm in Missouri. Are you in North Carolina? I know when I said as a mayor for the village of Hillsdale. I know what the ordinance is.
What's a mayor got to do with being a judge?
Shit. It's nothing, Joe.
But wait a minute, Joe. Every court of law that issues decisions, that ruling becomes part of the common law. All courts, to some extent, are common law courts. Every time they issue a ruling, that becomes part of the common law.
To become a federal judge, it's even harder, okay? You just can't become a federal judge, a U.S. District Court judge. It's even harder.
They set out, look, the courts, the Constitution sets up the crime to be a judge. And it doesn't specify how those requirements are laid out. It just establishes the
Constitution.
So,
no, the Constitution, you elect people to reset those requirements to be a judge. That's how it works.
That's what I'm saying. That's how those requirements are set. So, again, and they're set by the requirements of the Constitution because there aren't any specific requirements to be a judge, federal judge, in the Constitution. So it's left up to the elected officials to make the rules.
Yeah. And what Kat was trying to make, her point, what Kat was trying to make was that you'd have utter chaos in the courts if you had just regular citizens saying, I want this guy to represent me. I want this guy. You imagine what the appellate courts would be filled with? All nonsense. People suing over peanut butter and jelly and stupid crap like that, you know? You have to have some sort of professional conduct.
Another thing, a regular citizen can file an appeal and represent himself in Missouri.
Yes, a regular citizen can be pro se, yes.
Now, listen, I want somebody who has that law or supposedly requirement to cite me the code and section under the law of where it states that.
As far as the national?
States what?
Hang on. In my case that I'm talking about, it's a municipal law. You got towns, villages, and cities. Each one is a municipality. They write their own ordinance and set the stipulation from police chief, housing inspector, health inspector, on down the line.
Okay, well, who's got... Who made the statement that all judges have to be lawyers, supposedly in good standing with the bar, in the state, and everything? I want him to cite
you
me.
You had a chat room.
I want you to cite me the code and section where that appears in law.
And you know, there's more than one.